Okay, it is 105, March 9th, 2024. This is Prodigy of KCSI Dallas presents The Journey, our March 9th meeting. I am your host, David Knight, with Prodigy of K, and Casey Quillen is with us today, and Brian Edwards is running just a tad bit late, but he'll be here this afternoon as well. I wanted to first start off by saying thank you guys for participating, supporting our organization, and helping us do what we need to do to get this information out to the research community. I've got a few announcements this morning, or this afternoon, and the first one I want to get to is be sure to mark on your calendars the next Journey meeting, which will be sent out by email and also on our website, is going to be April the 6th at 1 o'clock. So April 6th at 1 o'clock is our next Journey meeting here on Zoom. And then 6 days later is going to be the student symposium that we're putting on here in Johnson County, Kansas, in Overland Park. I want to go ahead and do a quick share screen, and we're going to go over that information right now. There's a new tab on the ProjectJFK.com website known as the JCC Student Symposium. This here is where you're going to find all the information for the upcoming student symposium. We're going to be covering the topics of JFK, RFK, MLK. Special guest speakers are going to be myself, Casey Quinlan, Brian Edwards, David Denton, Larry Rivera, Doug Horn. Doug is going to be our keynote speaker of the conference, Beverly Sadowski, Ryan Jones, Ed Tatro, and J. Gary Shaw. For more information, you can visit prodigyfk.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out at prodigyfk@yahoo.com. The date of the event is going to be April 12th and 13th, 2024. We're going to start at 9 o'clock in the morning. We're going to go until 5 o'clock in the evening. We are going to take a one-hour lunch break. During that one-hour lunch break, the Zoom portion is still going to be staying running, but we will not be in that room, so there will not be a speaker during lunch as of right now. I'd rather us be able to all take a break, get some lunch, whether we're doing it on campus. There are restaurants available on campus. There is also restaurants available across the street, so it'll give the people in person a chance to have some lunch and talk with some of the speakers, and it'll also give you at home a chance to take a break and have some lunch. It's going to be at the Johnson County Community College at 12345 College Boulevard, Overland Park, Kansas, 66210. We're going to hold this in the Craig Community Auditorium that is known as the GEB building. For those of you coming in person, every building has a blue disc with a white outline and white lettering that has the initials of what building that is. This would be the General Education Building. It's going to be room 233. That's going to be on the second floor. Ticket prices for students, $5 a day in person at the door. Students, if they want to view this on Zoom, they can do this for the full event of $10. The general public price is $50, whether you are in person or you're on Zoom. I think this is a hell of a good bargain. I think we set the price where everybody can afford to come, especially the students, the younger generation. The reason why there's such a big difference between that price, I want to get students in the door, in their seats, and learning. We talk about this every time we have a Journey meeting or a conference. We need to pass this information on and get the younger generation involved in the research of the JFK assassination, also RFK and MLK. If you'll scroll down just a little bit, you will see the event details. Our key quote is, it is imperative that we get new researchers with fresh perspectives and new eyes looking into the assassination of three of the most important individuals of the 1960s. You can join us for this two-day symposium event. Basically, what I've also just informed you of, everyone is invited to attend our event, bringing together seasoned researchers and novice researchers as well, and those that have never even looked at this case. The JFK and RFK MLK assassinations defined the 1960s and changed the world. but there are still unanswered questions in the year of 2024. Their assassinations did not define these men, but what they did for this country and their sacrifice changed our history, your history, a history that is not left in the textbook and not taught. This symposium will open your eyes, and you will have the opportunity to learn from some of the best researchers and authors on these subjects. Down in the red section, you will see a map of my college campus. The GEB building is right here, kind of at the northern center of the map. And then there's also three parking spots. Actually, this fourth one over here, they're all within the best way of walking into the GEB building. There's handicap spots. There's their parking garages and flat top parking. So I do want to point this out that our symposium is going to start at 9 o'clock in the morning, but a lot of classes begin at 8 a.m. So the earlier, for those of you that are coming in person to get on campus, the better parking spots you're going to get. I also want to put this out. Please be respectful and keep your voices low in the hallways while classes are being held. This is on a live college campus. We're not holding this at a hotel. Now, I have tried to get rack rates for our attendees in person. Unfortunately, unless you're going to book 4 days, they don't want to give a rack rate, especially when you're not holding the event at their hotel. So I've included in this, you can also Google map the address of the school, the college, and you can see what's around in the area. There are a couple hotels that are really close, I mean right across the street basically, for $76 and $96 a night, and you may even be able to get that cheaper on one of the discount sites. You are on your own for your lodging while attending the symposium. I've included the three hotels that are close by with their phone numbers if you want to call and book a hotel with them. There are still rooms available. You are on your own for lunches and dinners while attending the symposium. During our lunch breaks, Friday and Saturday, you're welcome to take the short walk to the on-campus food court area. We have Pizza Hut, Boulevard Burgers and Chicken, a fresh and hot bar, salad bar, Firehouse Subs, Sushi with Gusto, if anybody likes sushi. There are also restaurants located to the north and the west in the strip malls on the corner of College and Quivira, which is where the school's at. We'll have the program and the schedule completed. It will be posted here as a PDF download. You'll be able to get that. It'll be probably later next week. And then there's a countdown. We've got 33 days and 18 hours before the conference begins. We've had some people sign up for conference tickets already. I just want to let you know there are a limited amount of seats in person, and there are a limited amount of seats on Zoom that we have, you know, set aside for this event. I can always add more seats on later, but the sooner that you get your ticket, the better you'll have a chance of making sure that you're booked into the event. So with that, this is also in association with David Denton's JFK Historical Group. He is going to be there speaking, and we like to work back and forth and join forces. That's what we do down in Dallas, what we did in Memphis last year, and at Olney Central College. So I think you guys will have a great event to attend. And this is what Doug is telling us will probably be his last in-person conference that he's going to do. So, I mean, Doug is one of those kind of guys that, you know, he's been there from the early days, and especially with the ARB. It's a great honor to have him at our event and on campus talking to the students and the public and the research community as well. So big shout out to Doug. And Beverly Sadowski is going to be there talking on RFK. Now, Beverly has not been at one of our events speaking, but this is going to be one of her first events with Project JFK that I'm aware of. I don't think I've had her anyplace else. I'm going to do a RFK 101, and then she's going to come in and present. She will be one of my Zoom speakers. So far, everybody is going to be in person on that list except for Beverly. Ryan Jones doing MLK, he is going to do his best to get there in person. Worst case scenario, he will be on Zoom. But this event will mostly have the biggest majority of people right there in person and in front of the students and the community. So with that, I just want to let you guys know about it. So please make sure you sign up for that. Also, I have to give a quick plug here. We have had a really great outpouring of support from our attendees of our event that donate to the cause. On the front page of our website, prodigyfk.com, there is a spot. So far, I have everybody's name caught up on the list. This money goes to, you're probably asking, well, what does my donation cover? Well, it doesn't go in our pockets. What it does, it keeps the website going, it keeps the bills paid, and it also helps with the conferences by putting them on and putting our events on. If you'd like to donate to that, please do. Donate whatever you like. No donation is too small. You can donate securely with our PayPal button. They take American Express, Discover, Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal. So I do want to thank again all the people that are on our list that have maybe those that had contributed and donated only one time. And then sometimes we have people that donate on a monthly basis. And I want to say a big shout out and thanks to all of our supporters of what we do at Prodigy FK CSI Dallas. All right. Now we've got that out of the way. I am going to bring on Mr. Snaff, our lead counsel here in our meeting. Tell us what's going on, Larry. How's it going in your world? And how is the what you can tell us of, how is the suit going?
If this meeting was 2 weeks later, I would have a lot to talk about. So there's not a lot I can say right now. There will be news. You know, we have until, I think, the 18th to file a notice of appeal to the Ninth Circuit. So we'll have news in a couple weeks. We are proceeding with researching our discovery issues. You know, the case that's remaining right now before the judge is the missing, destroyed, and removed records. Some of you who are subscribing to or listening to Jeff Morley's JFK podcast they saw an article earlier this week identifying 12 key records that we've identified, or sets of records, and there'll be articles for the next 12 weeks, I think it is, discussing in detail each of those categories of records. So we are firming up our research for purposes of discovery. Again, if you have any records that you think were removed, destroyed, or missing, please email me so I can forward that to the team. We have a couple other things outside of litigation that are going on. We are in the process of JFK Facts Podcast is in the process of accumulating names of representatives for our listeners. Let me say it again. The representatives that our listeners are constituents to. Let me say that again one more time. Listeners have representatives. We are asking our listeners to give us their names, the names of their representatives. I'm asking everyone on this site as well to please do so. Put it in the chat, and then David can send me the name. We're creating a spreadsheet of all of the representatives who have constituents that are interested in having the JFK Act. We are then going to give each of these people who have given us names of their representatives a form letter to send to the representative requesting that the JFK Act be reopened, reexamined, perhaps amended. We are working on corrective legislation. We also are, we believe we found someone who is a lobbyist, is willing to work with us to talk to some of the key representatives in Congress. You know, we do have the Justice for Kennedy Act that was introduced by Swiker from Arizona, but it got no traction. Since our last conference call, Representative Cohen from Tennessee sent in another letter to the president asking for the release of the rest of the records. Unfortunately, this time his letter was not co-signed by anybody else. Don't know why, but McGovern from Massachusetts has previously signed on to letters, and he's pretty high up in the Democratic leadership. So we're going to be targeting some Democrats to see whether we can come up with a bipartisan, I guess I would call it critical mass to try to get some work done on the Kennedy Act. I am also, David, I sent you the outline for people when they make requests to the archives about how to document those requests and how to pursue them, right?
I do not remember getting that, but let me look here in my email. Would you have sent that to the ProjectJFK at yahoo.com email address?
I would have sent it to you.
Oh, to the nightclub?
Yeah. I may have sent it to you last week, last time we spoke. I'll send it again. That should be up on the website so that anyone, when they make a request, this basically says first, make the request under the JFK Records Act. And then if you come back with an what you feel is an inadequate response, there's the next steps to do. And this is all part of the process of documenting how archives processes requests for records so that perhaps, you know, we can use – right now we just have anecdotal accounts. But if we basically don't want the archives to punt to FOIA, and if they do punt to FOIA – there's actually a process under FOIA that you can follow to basically put stuff, you know, create a record. Patrick, anything else that you think we could talk about the lawsuit?
Well, just to reiterate that, especially people on this broadcast, there are a lot of experts here, and they may be aware of documents that are lost or destroyed. And remember, there may be documents, as happened during the Bush 2 administration, that were they became disclosed, but then they were withdrawn from the, you know, from public view. So if anyone here is aware of anything of that nature, be sure to get in a email to either Larry or I'm sure Dave would be happy to convey it. And so you have we have here. Unusual spectrum of expertise. We'd like to take advantage of that, so don't be shy about writing in and suggesting. Even if you think it's obvious and someone already knew it, you know, anything you can think of might be helpful. Thank you.
We have a team, but, you know, there's half a dozen people. We could. It's very possible that because we're so busy, we could overlook something, even something obvious. So please, any records that you think are missing, reviewed. So basically, you can look at the we have to start with the ARB final report, and then you look at that. You know, are the records missing, removed, or destroyed? We have several rounds of discovery we can do, but this is the initial thing we're focusing on. This is what was the judge was most interested in. So again, anything that you think. And included to that is things, you know, we know, we're aware of the Darnell film. We're aware of the Marcello tapes that are sitting somewhere in the Fifth Circuit from the second sting. But any records that you think we're aware of the Donald Heath business, you know, the records that he said existed that are missing now. So, again, just send us that. And please. Everyone on this call, if you've already given us the name of your representative because you also listen to JFK Facts, that's great. But if you haven't, please give us the name of your representative. If you don't know it right now, look him up and then send us the name, because we want to get at least 100 representatives that we're gonna pressure. We can create. Believe it or not, Rob Reiner's series, the combination of Rob Reiner's series and the Parkland Doctors movie although it's not the same as the Oliver Stone movie, because this is a different era. You know, in those days, there were only movies, right? There were no internet. But anecdotally, I have friends who were previously thought that I was crazy, thinking there was a more than one man killing the president. And now they're interested in learning more. So this is another opportunity. In addition, for those who aren't aware, we're in a unique time about cold cases. So last year or the year before, Malcolm X's case got reopened. A representative city council person in New York City has now asked the DA to reopen or investigate Dorothy Kilgallen's murder. And just today or tomorrow, when it's going to get in the print, the New York Times is running a big piece on now there is a push to reopen the Lindbergh baby case. So we're actually in a really interesting time now for cold cases. And so let's strike while the iron is hot. So please put the name of your representative and also your email. Although I guess, David, you might know the email even if they don't include it, right?
Yeah, I do have the email of the attendees that are in the meeting.
Because we're going to send you back a form letter, and you can send the form letter as is, but you can also put it in your own words, you know, your own tone. But it's essentially the heart. We're basically telling you what to ask for. I think with that, Patrick, is there anything else that you think we should talk about, that we can talk about?
Not specifically, other than to say I came across a series which was including the so-called Innslaw scandal, and it involved the death of an investigative reporter back east in outside of, who I believe was in West Virginia. It's part of a new series about cover-ups and unsolved cases. I'm wondering if anybody else has come across that. It was on either Netflix or Prime Video, so it was major market.
That was on Netflix. It's the Octopus Murders suicide, but probably homicide of Danny Castellaro.
Yeah, that's it.
Casey and Brian and Craig Bozarth, we all went out to dinner at Texas Roadhouse. Craig comes all the way from Colorado just so we can go to a place called Texas Roadhouse for dinner. But hey, you can't take the Texas out of us guys. But yeah, we were talking about that, and I sat there and binge watched it twice. The first time I just watched it, and then the second time I went back and took notes. If anybody has not seen that miniseries, that documentary four part, they did a really damn good job of reenactments. Matter of fact, one of the guys that's doing the research, he kind of resembles Danny Castellaro when he was younger. Yeah. The fact of it is, though, is you're right, Patrick. I mean, now is the time where they say strike when the iron's hot, and cold case files and crime true crime podcasts. Let me get that out. Those are, you know, that's what I listen to every time I'm in the truck or if I'm just sitting around and I have it on the background. Sometimes I don't even watch TV. I'm just listening to a podcast. Only Murders in the Building kind of helped out with that a little bit on Hulu. It's kind of made the armchair quarterbacking of true crime popular again. So, yeah, definitely check that out. And I just want to throw this out. If you go to a streaming service called Tubi, T-U-B-I, and if you type in JFK, they have, I think the last time I counted, they had like 16 or 20 different documentaries and things on just the JFK assassination alone. And there's some that came out in 2023 that I had not seen. I've been usually pretty busy with my nose in a textbook and studying for an exam. But, yeah, there's quite a few that are out there. Russ, I see you got your hand up, buddy. You want to add something?
Just FYI, I worked on a team that investigated this back in the early 90s at the Village Voice, along with Doug Vaughn, who I believe maybe mentioned. I haven't finished watching the thing, but Doug Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-A-N, and several other people, including Frank Schnapp, a former CIA agent. We had a team at the Village Voice. I personally traveled to the Cabazon Indian Reservation back then, spent some time there. I also traveled to the Seattle area, where I spent time with Michael Reconosciuto. And I myself was told to go look for that tape that he had supposedly thrown by the side of the highway, if you know that from the show. Also, Michael claimed to me that I had discovered something of great importance. It was a thumb drive, but then he claimed that the thumb drive, you had to use it a certain way because otherwise the whole thing was going to blow up. And he said, you need to take it to somebody in authority. I took it to the counsel of a House committee investigating related things. He took it from me. He said they would have experts get access to it, and they would share it with me, and they never did.
That's very, very interesting, Russ. You've always got great contacts. I would love to talk to you a little bit more. I mean, the Castellero case, I was born during when that was going on, but I, of course, I was a young kid back then. I didn't know a hell of a lot about it, and I couldn't say that I would have given it much attention back then like I do now, because, hell, I question everything. And I'm always suspicious, especially when it comes to conspiracy theories. I'd definitely like to talk to you about that. I'm sure some of the other people, after they get a chance to, if they get a chance to watch that miniseries, would like to hear more about that.
I did meet with the makers. They contacted me. We met. I did not play a significant role in that. It seemed to me that the crux of now I've finished watching it, and I think it's excellent, by the way, very, very well done. But I think from an investigative standpoint, I'm not exactly sure what is new, just to be frank, because they're not just us at The Voice, but others as well went down that particular road quite a few times over the years. And it's interesting to see what Michael would say now, but it is. I will say, just as they said, that Michael's extremely confounding, and he's a very complex mix of truth and lies, very, very hard to sort it out. It does remind me of trying to unravel the Kennedy assassination because of the levels of complexity, the networks of power. Of course, I wrote a book about George H.W. Bush, and he has mentioned, I don't know how much they get into him on the documentary, but he's mentioned very prominently, he and Ed Meese, and of course, this Earl Bryan, who was in Reagan's cabinet in California, all of these figures, the CIA, the running of drugs and the using of drugs to finance covert operations, offshore accounts, and so on. These are all familiar themes we've seen with other stories like BCCI, Bank of Credit. If you're not familiar with that, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. I worked on that story too. Really, and then the Vatican Bank story. I mean, there are many, many stories and terrific books that have been done over the years. And all of these things kind of link up in terms of a huge network of people who really are have none of the morals or ethics that we ascribe to our country, and they will do whatever they have to do to get done what, as somebody says in this documentary very well, they're told are in the interest of national security, whatever that is.
Yeah, I want to ask you, when you talked to Mike, was he still in prison, or had he already got out?
Oh, he was in prison.
Okay. He's one of those guys that I didn't know quite. I'm into information technology, so I'm getting my degree in. So some of the things that he was discussing, especially about Promise, really piqued my interest. I do want to say that I was surprised when I saw BCCI, because if anybody knows the infiltrator story with Robert Musella, that was the bank that was taken down in the investigation. That involved the cartel. I was kind of, there was a lot of connections that I had seen before that crossed paths with the Octopus murders. So I appreciate the input, Russ.
David, I have a one last question for the group.
Sure, go ahead, Larry.
We are trying to run down the existence of a memorandum of agreement or understanding between the CIA and either the Church Committee or the HSCA. I've spoken to the remaining, some of the remaining people that, you know, alive that are worked on the Church Committee. And they don't really know if there was such an agreement. This is important because the executive branch is going to allege that although there may be records that are technically in the congressional archives, that they're going to, and the JFK Records Act does not apply to congressional records. Congress agreed to release records, but they weren't required to under the Act. The Act only applied to the president. So the argument is that the president has no authority to withhold congressional records. We are trying to determine the conditions under which information was given to the Church Committee or the HSCA that could have preserved the executive branch's equities in those records. So we're trying to run down if there is this, if there is in fact an MOU that was executed, or was this sort of like a handshake? So if anyone has any information about that, because so far the remaining Church Committee people I've spoken to, and that goes from Jim Johnston, who was the, one of the authors of Book 5, to someone that was the basically chief of staff for F.E.L. Schwartz, I think it's F.E.L., A.L. Schwartz, the general counsel for HSCA, they just don't remember. I'm not sure that Blakey is in a condition now where he could remember that as well. So just if anyone, any of the researchers here have focused on that issue, please let me know what you know. And with that, I turn it back to you, Dave.
Okay, Larry. I see that some people have been putting in their information as far as who's in who's in their state as far as the representative goes. Please make sure you put your email address in the chat log there. And Larry, the chat log for our last meeting, it's on the website. You can download the text document under the events tab. You'll go down and see where it says chat logs. And then this one here will be put up. It'll be up there by tomorrow. So if you just want to download that, you can send more forms up. Please keep up the good work on that. And everybody in attendance, please, you know, please find out who your representatives are so we can get that to Larry. And Larry,
we have 40 people here. I recognize about 10 that have been participating with the JFK facts. So we should be getting around 2,000 to 30 new names on this call.
Okay. And, also, we talked about this last meeting about doing a short video on how to request records. We talked about that, in depth last time. I am on spring break this week. Thank God. I need a break so I can get caught up on my JFK stuff and planning for the conference next month. But let's meet sometime this week, you and me, so we can do a quick Zoom video. And then we'll
I got a one-page PowerPoint that just lays out the procedure.
Okay, that'll be great. And that way we can put that in a video and get that on the website. Let's do that this week for sure. Yeah. And let's see here. Yeah, let's do that. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Snaff or Patrick?
David, am I on?
Yeah, you're on, Casey. Go ahead.
You look like a ghost, though.
I know. I'm a ghost anyway, I think. Anyway, I just wanted to thank Larry for all the work that he's doing up there, as well as Patrick and trying to define some of this material, because I just got back from a meeting early this morning where I was talking about you guys, and not specifically, but I was talking. It was actually a church meeting, so I was looking at this lady.
The CIA was getting to you.
You know that. But anyway, I was trying to describe to them that, you know, we do have people in Washington, D.C., and around the country that are lawyers that are legally going through the process of trying to get access to documents that we know are there, and it's a you know, democracy is a pretty fine process, but at the same time we still have to go through that material. So a big thanks to you, Larry and Patrick, for interpretation and stuff. And I also want to pat you guys on the back with the idea that the Octopus murders along with Danny Castellero. I think it was probably 30 years ago plus, but at the same time, and also to Russ Baker, who has brought out a lot more conspiracy theories that are out there rather than JFK, but they crisscross. I wasn't amazed at this, but I was amazed that it was brought out on the 4-part video program, and I think it was about Inslaw and the number of individuals' names, the important names who are on the board of directors, are some of the same people that we're looking at back in 1963 in conjunction with the murder of John F. Kennedy. And I don't know, I don't want to say it's an interlocking board of directors, but it certainly seems that way when you start to look at some of these other conspiracy theories, and they remain theories because we don't have access to some of that material to be able to prove anything like that. And in a lot of cases, I know that we can't get into the individual lawyers' archives, but we can certainly get into whatever congressional records, or at least we think that we can get into some of the congressional records and maybe the state records that our government has for us. So again, big pat on the back for you guys, and thank you very much.
So that actually triggers something as well. We've had a couple conversations over the last 2 weeks, and those of us who are on the JFK podcast, there was someone sent me a link. Oh, Jim Johnston from the HSCA sent me a link to, you know, I didn't realize that Today Show had done a whole week-long series following the Oliver Stone movie, interviewing key players. And one of them they interviewed was Joseph Califano. And he said on national TV that LBJ in 1966 considered that LBJ in 66 thought that Castro was behind the assassination. Forget for the moment that factoid. But he was thinking about reopening the investigation. And then he was persuaded not to. Just today, Peter Van Voskamp from the JFK Facts just shared something about Peter Lawford telling somebody that this went above Oswald. So there was this, like, we know, and then we know what Warren said, and we know what Hoover said. There was this, like, whispers amongst the elite in Washington during this time that they knew there was this went above the press, this went above, there was a conspiracy, but I guess in their judgment, they felt it was best for the country to go forward. And what Brian Gumbel didn't ask Califano in the clip that was made available was like, okay, if Johnson concludes that Castro was behind the assassination, the next question was, why did he not do anything? Like, how can you let someone killing the president get away with it? And it seemed like all the people in power just wanted to move on. So there may not be actual records. We were told also that Patrick, I'm forgetting his name now. The representative in Congress had done an investigation on his own. Who's the guy that said it?
Pike.
What?
Pike.
No, not Pike, Joe. Were you on the call the other night? It's a Southern senator that done an investigation.
Cooper.
Who's it?
Cooper.
No.
A senator or a congressman?
Senator. Fulbright.
Russell. Maybe Dick Russell.
Fulbright. That he'd done something. Oh. And, you know, we may want to look at his papers. I have someone looking at the ARB papers right now to see if there's anything post-ARB. Because there's a bunch of Clinton files pertaining to the ARB that are post the end of the ARB. But we need to start looking to see if some of these people that are now dead, if there's anything in their papers. Their papers may be the only trace. There's probably not going to be any record of an investigation, but there may be some correspondence. So we also need to come up with a list of people that we've heard. We know that Monahan supposedly did something for Bobby. So you know, we got to start thinking about looking at, and Russ Baker knows about this. He's a journalist, and, you know, you have to sometimes go to different sources to find information. So that's another whole level of things that I think we as a group maybe need to organize research in different areas other than the usual records that may not exist anymore. David, that's all I have to say.
By the way, I'm friendly with Moynihan's daughter, if you're talking about Pat Moynihan.
Yeah.
And she's told me over the years she definitely believes that that there was more to the Kennedy story. She also was, by the way, Carolyn Kennedy's college roommate.
Ah. Now, so the interesting thing would be to follow up to see what happened. You know, was this all a verbal thing that her father did with Bobby, or was there something somewhere in writing somewhere that could be looked at? You know? Anyway, that's interesting. Thank you.
Hey, David, it's Brooks.
Go ahead, Brooks.
I'm going to go back to Octopus Murders and just make a comment, and I'm surprised it hasn't been brought up. But in episode 3, there's an investigative journalist, Sherry Seymour, I think was the name, and she's tracking down this John Philip Nichols, who's involved in this network and may to some extent have been the mastermind behind a lot of this. But anyway, she's meeting with him. His wife is present. And in the midst of this discussion they're having, he plays the Zapruder film. And he plays the version we all know, and then he plays another version shortly after that. And this is all in slow motion. It's very precise. You can see a lot of detail. In the second version, the driver, Bill Greer, turns, looks back at JFK with a handgun and shoots him. And so she says, "What is this?" And he says, "This is the real film."
By the way, Brooks, just to clarify, that's not John Nichols. That's Robert Nichols.
What was it, Robert Nichols? Okay.
Yeah, they're not related. I spoke to either one or both of them. It's been so many years. He's a very tricky character, that guy.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to say, I've done the math on this, so I just wanted to share a handgun, whether it's a .22, a 9mm, whatever. You look at the speed of the bullet. The Zapruder film is 18 frames. But the way the camera works is the shutter opens, the shutter closes, and it alternates. And so the film is 18 distinct pictures while the shutter's open, giving you an exposure of what happened in those few milliseconds before the shutter closes again. And when you do the math, in that interval of the shutter being open, a bullet from a handgun would typically travel about 10 feet. So when she says she's looking at the film and she holds her finger up and she says, you could see the bullet traveling and Kennedy's head explodes. So I just want to say she's full of shit.
That's absurd.
Yeah, that was one of those things where I saw it in the preview for that episode, and that part of it kind of led a little bit of discredit to, you know, to the whole story as a whole. But then again, you can't judge an entire, you know, program to one person's input.
I'm not denigrating the program. I'm just saying
two possibilities.
Right. Either she saw what she saw or she didn't. But if she saw what she said she saw, then they're jerking her chain and to a point. And I think part of what she also said about the film is you can see how the film was altered. She talks about the tree and all of that. So she's going into detail. But in other words, somebody's come up with a very creative version of this film that shows Greer shooting the president.
Right.
And again, obviously, that's a man-made iteration.
That's designed to make the research committee look like a bunch of idiots.
That's exactly what it's designed to do, Mary. That's exactly what it's about.
A gullible person sees this, and then, you know, and then it becomes, it's a counterintelligence operation.
Well, I saw this as, okay, if somebody was to, you know, the way I looked at it was kind of, you know, two sides of the coin. You know, she states what she saw, but was she showed something in order to discredit her later on if she came out to say, well, this on something completely different, or maybe on the Octopus Murders. You know, if she comes off, here's the way I see it. If they can make you look like a nut job or a nutcase and not to be believable, then that gives a discredit, you know, for later on if you decide to bring something out that, you know, actually does have importance. They could come back and say, well, no, this person made this claim and, you know, there's no way this could happen. So in kind of a way, it's almost like a way of being able to discredit, you know, later on for that person's
exactly
point of view. So
I just raised the issue so that none of us are duped by what she's
professing. Well, that was actually one of the reasons why I didn't even talk about that earlier. Not that I didn't want to like give that away that it's in one of the episodes, but I didn't put a lot of credence to it. You know,
let me interject here primarily because it is a controversial type thing, and we as researchers over the years we read so many books on this, and then we come up with the possibility of theories. If you do look in the Warren Commission documents, you'll find probably about four or five people, eyewitnesses on top of the and I can't think of their names right in front of me, but basically they said that they saw. Now, they were on top of the railroad bridge, and they saw the driver what appeared to be some sort of a weapon in his hand. And if you go back, and I'm not saying that has taken place, but that's what they said. Even let me see who else said that. A couple of the ladies on the side said that they thought they saw the driver with a gun. And then
Jim Hill and Hugh Betzner.
Yes. And the yes, very good. And the other one is that you get Doug Horn's five-volume books, and I can't remember which book it is, but there's a section in there where he says, well, he gets a hold of one of the stewards on Air Force One who gives information to him, and Doug said he's not going to give his name out, but at the same time he said that one of our Secret Service agents, and I think it was Hill, came in, pulled his shirt off because it was full of blood, and he wanted to change clothes, and he was looking at himself in the mirror, and this is what the steward said that he said, is that as I was trying to get in the car, here I have Greer pointing his pearl-handled or ivory-handled weapon at him as he's trying to get onto the car. Now, maybe that fueled a whole bunch of different ideas that maybe the driver may have pulled the weapon out. I think he did. Did he shoot him? I have no idea. But it certainly,
I don't think it's fair to say you have no idea. There is no, I think this is the problem. This is why we need Russ Bakers of the world, because a lot of researchers don't know how to evaluate eyewitness testimony. And experienced journalists, people that are used to investigating people, know how to dissect eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony is only really good to corroborate hard evidence because eyewitness testimony is inherently unreliable, particularly in a situation like an assassination. And to say that you don't know, there is absolutely no evidence except for perhaps some misunderstood statements that this driver who was driving had his hands on the wheel, turned around and pointed a gun. So to say that you don't know, I think that's not the way to say it. It's like, is it absolutely 100% that he didn't do it? No. But it's probably 95% that this is just an unreliable account because there's no other evidence. And this is another part of the problem of researchers not being sophisticated in their research. A lot of people, in the goodness of their heart, they're looking for stuff, but they don't know how to evaluate. There are people that are great writers. There are people that are great researchers. And there are a lot of people that are not good researchers. And this is when we review people's work, we have to understand that. Like when you interview a witness, there may be a witness. Let's take the guy that claimed he saw Oswald in Dallas in 60 with what's his name in September. He may have the wrong year down, but some people are not good with time, but they're really good with the observations they make when they're in a situation. So the fact that Benicio said he may have seen Oswald, in the bank building in September 63, the fact he may have of the wrong month, the wrong year, may not mean that the heart of his testimony is wrong. He particularly may not be good with remembering years. Each of us have different strengths in our abilities to recall events. But I just am really hesitant to say that you can't say that he didn't pull a pistol out. You can't. There's very little evidence to that. You can't say he did, but it's unlikely that he did. Don't say this is like 50-50. Anyway, Joe has his hand up.
There was a guy in the 70s, I think his name was Cooper, went around with a degraded black and white version of the Zapruder film, saying, you know, like, this is the real film. This is the real Zapruder film. And he's the one largely responsible for the idea that Greer turned around and shot JFK. And it's not true at all. Greer's hands never leave the wheel. What he's saying is a gun is really the reflection of sunlight off of Kellerman's head. There's no truth to the idea that the driver shot JFK. There's another thing I was going to say. Veziano is the guy claimed that he saw David Attlee Phillips with Oswald in Dallas. There's no truth to that either. John Newman has shredded that based on Veziano's changing story. He's got the travel records of Phillips, so he knows where Phillips
is. I agree with that. There's no truth in the Veziano sighting.
Right. I was just pointing that out as an example that some people, because a person has the time of the year or the year wrong.
But there's more than that with Veziano. About Veziano is BS on that.
Right.
Yes.
I was just using that as an example. There's more reasons not to believe his account, but I'll just point out that people, eyewitnesses have different strengths. And you have people that are very anxious people that, you know, our brains are not tape recorders. And every time you recall a memory, it alters a little bit. So I don't care, you know, you have to be very careful when you're listening to people. And it depends on what kind of question you ask. So, but that was an example of just saying you can't dismiss witnesses just because they may have the wrong day down or something. You have to look at the whole context of their testimony. And journalists like Russ Baker, they're used to evaluating, and lawyers are used to evaluating the credibility of witnesses. So one statement on its own is even not dispositive either way, but you have to look at the totality of their testimony.
David, let me jump in and answer Larry in my comment. And since we are talking to a lawyer here, I think he's absolutely correct. So I stand corrected on my terminology, what I use. But what I was trying to point out that if you read the Warren Commission documents, you do have a number of eyewitnesses said that they saw something in that car. And I don't dismiss that, but at the same time, answer some of the other people, I've never believed that the driver actually did anything like that, but he may have pulled a gun or something out. That's what several people have said. Now, is that true? I don't know. I don't know in that aspect if that's not true. But I don't think that we have enough material to be able to say that he actually fired a gun at the president. So, yeah, I think what happens is that you, right in the middle of that octopus murders, you're looking at in fact, I asked myself, why was this brought out in the middle of this octopus murders? What, to get us fueled up and fired up over something that maybe we've already dismissed? And I have to agree with Larry that I think so. I think we have, for the most part, dismissed it, but you still have people that are sitting there going, my God, this is what happened. I go, no, I don't think it did happen. But there are eyewitnesses that
the idea that a driver who, I mean, that he's going to take his hand off the wheel, reach for a gun, turn around. I mean, the driver's not the guy that's going to do that. It just doesn't make any sense. Anyway. Okay, we had our first big interesting conversation for the day.
Well, I think, you know, some things can be put out there as misdirection, whether it's, whether it's on purpose by the filmmaker or the news reporter, you know, things happen where, you know, we get misdirection, and then we ask questions of going, okay, sometimes that causes infighting. Sometimes it, you know, takes our eyes off of the, so to speak, off the prize of, you know, getting to the bottom of something. And let's face it, when it comes to the JFK assassination, it has been interjected into so many areas of media, TV shows. You know, I got asked the question in history class, why do I deal with the JFK assassination, and why is it still so prominent in our culture? I mean, it's spanned the generations, and I think one of the reasons why, one, we don't have the truth. We are people that go out and look for it. And then the other aspect of it is, you know, we do have Hollywood to thank for the fact of, you know, keeping it in the public's memory, short term and long term. I mean, hell, even The Simpsons. I was showing Casey a cartoon clip from Family Guy where you've got Peter Griffin shooting a Carcano outside of his living room window. But
they settled the case. No publisher. And to bring a claim for slander or libel, it is a very, very high standard. For a publisher to claim that they found the answer to the crime of the century, to then settle after the plaintiff has blown their statute of limitations, tells you about the veracity, the lack thereof, of that claim. And don't say anything about legal fees. This thing would have been dismissed on a summary judgment, and they still decided to settle. And if he had run the trajectory back to the Dow Tex building, as Norman says, that is actually the trajectory. If they just run it back past Hickey, back to the Dow Tex building, one could conceivably say that was the same trajectory. Anyway, I just want to make a point that the publisher settled. No publisher is going to settle on legal fees if they've solved the crime of the century.
Thank you, Larry. Well, so far it looks like we've got the moles out of our group here. We will continue with our meeting. I do want to apologize. I've got some editing I'm going to have to do before this video is put up on YouTube.
Hey, that might really get make a lot more views.
Yeah, the bad part about it is it'll get our channel flagged. So, yeah, I have to go in and do some serious cuts on that. But unfortunately, that's what happens when you host something where, you know, it's open to the public, anybody can come to it, and, you know, they're not on our email list, so they're getting in. They're getting in through either Zoom or through Eventbrite. So, we will continue to report, and then they won't be able to use the email once Zoom gets done with them. So, they want to sit around and play games. We have to unfortunately put up with the shit that they decide they want to deal out to us. And with 450 people that the email goes out to, plus the ones that arrive on Eventbrite, it's hard to keep a track on every single person. So,
this is Casey. I want to ask Brooks, who did you say was talking about that about 10 years ago, or you had a conversation?
Tim Nicholson.
Tim Nicholson. And, I was not on the meeting that we had when Tim Nicholson got online here. And I told David I understand the First Amendment rights and everything, but Tim Nicholson is not one of us guys. I'm not sure who he is, but at the same time, he's a lone gunman, and I think what he wants to do is to disrupt everything. And, you know, we're talking about the possibility of eyewitnesses and ear witnesses that basically in the Warren Commission and Warren Commission documents, but I think what Larry Schnapp is saying basically, and also what several of the people have reiterated, the idea that, you know, we have to look at these witnesses and weigh out what is, you know, what is real in this whole thing, especially if we're trying to figure out where we're going to go with this. But I just wanted to point out that there were several people that had seen the driver do certain things. But at the same time, I don't think there's basically any evidence at all that the driver did anything such as some of these people are saying. Again, we can go back and start to question the entire Zapruder film as to whether or not that film is intact or whatever. But at the same time, anytime you have something like this, it's going to cause people to ask questions. And plus that, you're going to go back in and you're going to start pulling books down and start pulling material out. And I think in the long run, I think maybe that's what a lot of these people are trying to do, is to discredit whatever work that we're trying to do. And we're trying to find the truth. And I think most of us who are on here are trying to find the truth. And we're going to open up our minds and our books and everything to try to get to that truth. And then sometimes, as many books as I've read, I've had to discard some of these books, but I still have to read them. And so it's just one of those things where we get some people like Tim Nicholson and the people who are going to get online, and hopefully that he doesn't get online with this situation. So.
Well, I have a question for Larry Schnapp. Is Larry still here?
Yes,
there he is. Hi, Larry. You being a lawyer, I'm rereading the Warren Report. Last time I read it was 1980. So I'm highlighting, and as I reread it, I can't believe how general they are in their terms, as the word probably must be in there 1,000 times, or likely, or the commission believes. From a legal standpoint, I just can't believe they got away with, you know, there seemed, as in chokeholds, there seems to be no standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. Would you agree with that? Or?
Yes. No, they were judge, jury, and prosecutor. And they did not, my sense, they did not look at this as a criminal matter. And so they looked at things as purely a civil level of burden of proof. And they not only drew inferences from the evidence that was not supported by the evidence itself, but also not supported by the evidence in the exhibits. The report is a whitewash. Their summary of what they believe the evidence says, but it's not necessarily what the evidence really stands for. It's just a lot of overstatements. Patrick, you got your – I'm sure you have things you want to say.
Just one more question. I'm sorry. I just have one more question while you say that. Has there anybody that ever attacked the Warren Report from that standpoint, like chapter by chapter, particularly back in the 60s, 70s, how ridiculous it was?
So Mark Wayne, in his Rush to Judgment, did take a legalistic view of things. And again, remember, not only are they drawing inferences from evidence they chose to collect, they ignore lots of other evidence that were exculpatory in nature, or when they – you have to also understand the way the Warren Commission collected its information. They did – Warren, over the objections of the staff, allowed unrecorded preliminary interviews with witnesses, which allowed them to screen out the bad witnesses. And then those witnesses that they had to interview, because they were important, whenever they diverged from the official position, the Warren Commission would say they believed they were unpersuasive, or they disagreed with their conclusions, or that their recollections were wrong. So those are the kind of things that there's a lot of legal machinations that are, you know, look, these were very good lawyers, Arlen Specter and et cetera. They knew how to manufacture a record. And so they manufactured the most favorable record, and they drew all the favorable inferences they could to the case. Patrick?
Well, you know, bottom line, many of us believe, I mean in this audience, that the Warren Report is a political document aimed to achieve certain ends, and that they had marching orders. The FBI report was released. Even in their executive sessions, the Warren Commissioner said that the leaking of the FBI report handcuffed them in a certain kind of way. And they also complained that they were the recipients of all information from the FBI and the CIA, and they didn't have an independent body to do investigation of their own.
Right.
And so there's actually a recording of LBJ on the phone with Russell, Senator Russell, and Russell says, this is right at the end when we're signing off on it, and LBJ wants a unanimous verdict, as it were, from the commission. And Russell says, you know, I just can't sign off, and he doesn't use these words, but he says the single bullet theory and that Oswald did all this shooting with that gun in that amount of time. And LBJ says in this recorded conversation on the phone, I don't believe it either.
Right.
But we got to get this thing done.
And the other thing, Rick, is the rules of evidence were not new in the investigation. The rules of evidence have been established to ensure that reliable evidence is introduced into a court proceeding. So, for example, when they would be interviewing the FBI forensic experts, there was no cross-examination to determine if, you know, if the FBI wanted to cover this up. They gave Frazier and those guys would make their statements. And even the statements that Frazier made about, say, the fibers were overstated in the report. So a lot of the evidence that the Warren Commission relied on would have at least had an instruction in a trial by a court telling the jury to evaluate the questions on the reliability of that evidence when they're evaluating the evidence. Some of the evidence would have been inadmissible. I take the position, and I have spoken to Bert Griffin about this, that a lot of Marina's testimony would be inadmissible because in 1963, a spouse could not testify against a spouse. And in fact, we raised this in the mock trial, and we were going to do motion practice on this to eliminate all Marina's testimony. But because of the constraints of time, we decided to allow her testimony to be in, and we were going to attack it and then have the judge just give an instruction. So there's a lot of evidence that was relied on that I don't think would have either been admitted, or if it was admitted, there would have been questions raised for the jury to consider.
Well, just while we're on this particular subject, just for 1 minute, I would say, too, that when you look at the conduct of the Dallas FBI office and the note that Oswald delivered within 2 weeks of the shooting or so, it was immediately destroyed as soon as Oswald died, because they said, well, there's not going to be a trial, so we're off the hook on that. So that immediately eliminated certain safeguards and so forth. Excuse me. I'm finished.
I see that Ron Raquel had his hand up a couple of times. Ron, did you want to add something? And then I'll get to the other two people that have their hands up, Beverly and Scott.
Yeah. Hi, David. I just wanted to let you know that there's a young researcher on YouTube by the name of Alex Harris. He's 14 years old. He goes by the JFK theorist. He's pretty shrewd person for a 14-year-old person, and he has a ton of videos out there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've actually ran across some of his stuff on YouTube.
Yeah. Just wasn't sure if you had known, just to maybe have him at the conference or reach out to him.
Yeah, maybe we'll see if maybe he can join on Zoom. I'll do that, Ron. Scott, you had your hand up next.
Yes, I could add that he did a very tremendous presentation at Lancer. And for somebody that age to have the level of interest and knowledge and the poise that he has is really extraordinary. So I would definitely recommend that. What I wanted to ask was maybe a very naive question, but from a legal technical standpoint, since the Warren Commission was not in itself a court and it didn't follow the way a legal process would, what is the classification of this case? Is it technically an open case?
Yeah. I mean, it was an open case even in 1980 when the FBI declined to, I think, what was it? They declined to do the forensic evidence at that point.
Yes.
I think you got the
acoustics, especially.
Acoustics, right, the acoustics. There is actually, and I think I've mentioned to you guys in the past, there is a mechanism under Texas law to bring a court of inquiry, even today, to try to expunge Oswald's arrest. We had Bill Simpson and I had asked Marina Oswald for permission to do this in 2018, and she declined. And one of the things we're going to – this would be a real live case where we go get a judge. This is a discretionary action. It's not mandatory. You file a petition with the judge to – sort of like with the Innocence Project, where we provide – we assert that there's Oswald's arrest for killing the president, that there was no that it should be expunged based on the lack of probable cause. And we're going to try to revisit this with the daughters to see whether they would be willing to do this to help, you know, expunge the taint of their father's alleged crime on them. It's that the Warren Commission has no real legal precedent in a court of law.
And the second part of the question, which I believe you've answered, is since it wasn't against federal law at the time, Dallas would be the jurisdiction for this?
Yes. Actually, the attorney general at that point, the district attorney general at that point, was going to do a court of inquiry, and Johnson shut him down. That was what the Warren Commission is. But that is an unsolved – that's an unsolved crime. And now, the statute technically does not contemplate a defendant being killed in police custody. He's been convicted in the court of public opinion, but he hasn't been convicted in a court of law. But there is a procedure, and in fact, remember John Orr at the end in the late 90s got the FBI to reexamine materials on the bullet fragments, and when they found out they were human, he wanted to try to do DNA on it, and they have stopped. They haven't followed up. So it's still an open case on the books.
Beverly, you've got your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, since you're talking about the Warren Commission, and somebody mentioned Bert Griffin, because I had talked with him extensively twice in 2015, one-on-one here in the Cleveland area.
Yeah, he mentioned
and it was pretty interesting. And he recently, you know, he wrote this now new nonsensical book. And so he was at some of our public libraries here doing a talk. So Doug Horn and I attended it, and basically we eviscerated him there. I mean, it was – most of the people there, I think, realized what he was saying was, like, ridiculous. Of course, you had some people who were, oh, no, I want to hear the judge, you know. But – by the time I had multiple people coming up to me and asking me about, you know, information and whatever. But I mean, he was completely, so I was going to attend a second one because I had so much more that I could have said to him about Oswald or whatever. And then I thought, I'm not wasting my time with this guy. But he, I think in his case, it's, you know, cause he started out pretty, aggressive when he was talking to some of those when he was on the Ruby investigation, but they got him in line there pretty close. You know, they didn't even let him go to Dallas, you know, even though he should have been the one talking to Ruby. But I think he's to a point now, he's 93. I think he's to a point where it's like what I would say cognitive dissonance. He's got to continue to rationalize what they said in the Warren Commission. But like I said, it was pretty amusing, really, what happened in when he did this recent talk just this past February.
Yeah, Bev, I actually spoke to him also, I think, in 2017 when we were going to have him speak at Lancer. And I think what happened is that he got pressure from Olens to stop giving us all this information.
Mm-hmm.
It was remarkable. When Jeff Morley and I interviewed him for his book, the first thing I asked him was, you begin your book with a criticism of the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
About their investigative techniques. And then you spend the rest of your book defending their conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was clear at some point. I stopped pressing him because it was clear that he's like Clint Hill. Clint Hill will see that the back of the president's head's blown out.
Yeah.
But he can't get his brain to tell him that means there's a stop in the front.
That's right.
An emotional block or some. And Bert is also burdened by patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
Really feels that this is bad for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame. I mean, he's at a point. I'm very friendly with him. I'm very polite, like you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think what did he say? You kind of like, did you work for him?
No, no.
But you're kind of like a little shadow of him, right? You shadow him around?
Yeah.
I mean, your name came up in the interview.
No, that's interesting. Well, and I also spoke at length with Paul Landis in 2017. And, he talked about, you know, coming around the car, seeing the president's wound or whatever. And then I read him Clint Hill's description. And I said, is this what you agree? Do you agree with this description? And he said, yes. And then I showed him the most ridiculous picture of the, you know, with Kennedy's hand apparently completely intact. And I said, well, then how do you explain this? And of course he had no. And then I also read him what was written in Tip O'Neill's book, what Dave Powers Kenny O'Donnell had said about believing that there were shots from the front, and but then they kept quiet and, you know, all that. And I said, well, and then I read him his own contemporaneous report where he said he thought there was definitely one from the right front. And again,
I was with him for a day and a half at Pittsburgh, and it's weird because he's accounting, he doesn't take it the next step. He found the bullet, he thinks, and he doesn't process that means that the lung gunman theory is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And when you ask him, somebody pressured him. In fact, when Hill, I was given not direct access, but I was told what the emails were between Hill and Landis when Landis told him he was publishing his book. And Hill did not tell him don't publish it because it's untrue. He told him not to publish it because of the consequences or mm-hmm. ramifications or something, right? So now Paul, when he's pressed, will say, well, you know, we were at the front of the shooting. That was maybe that was an echo. So he's now, you know, because he's under pressure again.
Right.
He is very protective of the Secret Service, him and Clint Hill. And so he doesn't want to do anything that would cast the Secret Service in ill light.
Mm-hmm.
But he's clearly traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting story.
Well, yeah, because he left after 6 months. This was his dream job, and he left the Secret Service after 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Scott, you got your hand up. You want to add something more?
Yes, I attended one of those Bert Griffin talks at Shaker Heights Library, and it was strange because I've been to so many conferences and events over the years. It was the first one where I was the only one who didn't believe in the Warren Report. Everybody else there was buying into it entirely. And he had a good way of presenting it. I definitely think he did a good job, particularly for somebody of his age, and had a logical way of putting forth his point. The book, however, its main fallacy is it is so much based on Marina and Lee as being a source of the psychological aspect of Oswald, yet Marina herself has discredited that book many years ago, so it's odd that he's still holding on to that. I chatted with him a little bit after the event, but I didn't want to get into anything controversial, so I just mentioned, oh, we have the same publisher and the fact that they don't support their authors at all. And he laughed. He says, yeah, I found that out.
Thank you, Scott. I do want to take a quick pause here and let you guys know, one, I want to apologize for the interruptions we've had today. There's two new things that are going to be implemented for our next meeting and for anything going on in the future. The first thing is going to be, you know, I like it when, you know, you guys share your screen, providing the fact that it's not what we had earlier in the meeting. So there's going to be a new implementation that screen sharing will be turned off. You will need to ask me to allow you to share your screen instead of just automatically throwing something up on the board. That goes for the remainder of this meeting as well. It's just something I got to do to protect people that are in our room, especially with the you know, images that were posted on the screen earlier. The other thing is going to be the email will go out to everybody to sign up for the tickets. Of course, it's listed on Eventbrite. We have followers on there. I will be going through and checking that following list and deleting anybody that is not part of our group. Unfortunately, they're, you know, if they want to come back to one of our meetings, they're going to have to re-sign up again. But, you know, to put the security of our meetings, you know, being the top priority, it's things I have to do. The last thing I'm going to do is instead of allowing tickets to be sold until like 3 o'clock, I do that for the people that maybe show up late. Unfortunately, I'm going to start cutting ticket sales off to our event where you can sign up for a ticket 1 hour before our event starts. So since our event starts at 1 o'clock, you need to sign up no later than 12 o'clock. That way it gives me an hour to go through the list and make sure that anybody that I see is not a valid attendee that we've had in the past, or those are the ones that I can highlight where I can watch them to make sure. Because what was going on a while ago is we had about 15 tickets sold after 1 o'clock. Now, of course, Beverly was a couple of those, and I understand that. But the fact of it was is they would come in with one email. They changed their name, so every time they would pop up on the screen and, you know, say something, they would immediately change their screen name. So I'm sitting here playing whack-a-mole, trying to get the people found and get them out of the room as quickly as possible. So the ideas of moving forward with our meetings and our events, I just want to let you guys know when you get the email. And if for some reason that, you know, you happen to forget, email me directly or give me a quick phone call and say, hey, I need the meeting ID and information. I know who you are. And then I can either text it to you, email it to you, or, you know, just send you a quick link to get in. But unfortunately, you have, you know, bad actors and, well, I'm just going to say assholes that want to, you know, interject themselves into a meeting that they have no reason to be here other than to cause disruptions. So coming from the host and from one of the co-directors of Project JFK CSI Dallas, I want to let you guys know that I don't condone that. I do condone free speech, but I do not condone what happened today in this meeting. We've been fortunate enough. This has actually really happened to us since about a year ago. I mean, obviously we're getting seen by people, but it's the wrong people sometimes that we get seen by. I want to switch gears and I want to talk about something. I know that Meek and Blau is not in our audience today, but they were here last time. They sent out an email. It is a genuine email, by the way, about doing a survey on the JFK assassination. Now, I don't know how many people in our audience that had actually taken the time to fill that out, but you did receive a follow-up email given the results of that. I'm just going to do a quick screen share myself here and show you the results. So survey results on the topic of motive, February 29, 2024. What's great about this is Paul, and this is, I want to make sure I get their names correct. It's Jeff Meek, Paul Blau, and also Dave Boylan. What I like about this is I used to send out questionnaires of the Lancer Conference when we've done things with our organization as well, going, hey, what did you like? What can we improve on? Is there anything you want to discuss or bring up in the next event? Possibly sometimes we wound up getting new speakers involved. But this survey is different from that. This is asking the hardcore questions of what do you as researchers think? And then they broke it down into a PDF that gives you graphs, goes over the questions, and they got, let me see here, they sent out a mass email to 430 recipients, and they got 146 responses back. Now, that's a pretty damn good response back. They are going to continue doing this, so definitely check your email, and that way your vote, but your opinion can get counted, be put into the report, and then go over that report. Find out what other people are thinking and what they're feeling of, you know, what they think either happened, where we can go from, you know, where we are today. So I just want to throw that out. Those guys are doing really great work. They're also some of the authors of Chokeholds. And I want to throw this out at you. I do not have the exact date yet, but in May we will be doing I'm bringing back the Spotlight. I've been talking about it since January. But Spotlight, if you guys aren't familiar, Spotlight at Boston newspaper, they would pick a story, and they would spend time researching that story to bring out the spotlight articles on what they were doing. It's kind of the same thing I'm doing, where I don't want to just take and throw somebody up on the screen for 3 hours and usually it's about a 3-hour meeting. It needs to be important. It needs to be a spotlight of that person, of their research. Maybe it's an author of a book. In particularly the Chokeholds book, I'm working on doing a spotlight if I can work out the time for all those. There's 5 authors, so I want to get them all on a panel discussion for the May spotlight. Now, also the following month in June, we're going to do kind of a back-to-back on books and authors. In June, I want to do one on Admitted Assassin, the book that J. Gary Shaw, Brian Edwards, and Ricky White wrote. That'll give you guys time. If you haven't already ordered your copy, please order it and get it read. I know I'm in the process right now of finishing that one up. I just got Chokeholds last week. Actually, me, Brian, and Casey all got Chokeholds. So we're in the process of getting that book read. And as a host, and as a fellow researcher, I want to make sure I'm well-versed on what they're going to come on and talk about, at least what I have of their book. You know, authors like to share things that maybe weren't in the book. So, you know, it's a great opportunity to hear from them, hear the research, the book itself, and what they are introducing and have introduced to the research community. So, like I say, pencil it in May and June. We're going to have back-to-back spotlights on those 2 books and those authors. Bob, you've got your hand up. Go ahead, buddy.
Thanks, David. Just on those 2 last topics you addressed, we'll defer until your spotlight, but I see that Brian is here. And as an early reader of the book, I wanted to commend him and Gary for facilitating Ricky's getting his experience and thoughts into this volume. I have read it, and I find it extremely intriguing, and I have absolutely no, you know, ulterior interest in promoting this book other than to say that it's worth the read. And the authors, I think, approach it in a very credible way by basically saying, look, this is what this young man found about his dad, and here's the evidence, and here's what we know, and here's what's missing, and so forth, and in effect saying, look, draw your own conclusions and communicate with us. That was great. The second thing is about the survey. What I thought was intriguing about the survey, and it was a little bit of a watershed moment for me, I'm one of those people that goes back to Gen 1 in the late 60s, and every time I've been asked who do you think, I've never been able to really formulate a strong opinion, but I've had the list of possibilities. And what I thought was clever about this, you can call it clever, but it was a little bit disruptive to my thinking about the survey, is that the question would ask, among many, many different possibilities, how do you weight who might have been responsible? And then it was immediately followed up by the bombshell question, which is pick one. And I had to actually think about that for a day or two, and it's the first time in my 50 years or so that I've actually been able to get there, to get to a point where I thought that the preponderance of evidence in my experience led me to one as emerging. So at minimum, there's value in just thinking it through. You know, I know his questionnaire is now closed, but among people who studied this, being asked that simple question about who and having to commit to it is quite a challenge. And the fact that it's a challenge supports the notion that, again, we still don't have everything we need to really know. So I just wanted to share that experience with the survey and recommend Brian and Gary and Ricky's book, and I'm looking forward to the spotlight session. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I am also going to reach out to Paul and ask him if it's okay. I'm sure he won't have a problem with it, but I want to post the results on the ProdigyFK.com website. That'll be something probably in the blog section. But once I get the approval of that, the PDF will be, hopefully it'll be available to download. Even if you did not get a chance to fill out the questionnaire, at least you can see the results of, 146 people weighing in on the questions that they asked.
I would make another recommendation to you, David. If you're going to get permission for that, see if you can get permission to also capture the unfilled out survey, because the results don't capture what I was saying about the survey.
Let me see if he'll let me put the survey itself up, and then also, now of course the survey won't be something that can be filled out. You'll have to do that through the direct link that they send out. But maybe we can put that as a pre-unfilled part, and then also the results, so that way people can see what the questions were, instead of just the summary and the graph. But yeah, very, very good point. I appreciate that, Bob. Let's see here. Well, we're coming up to the 3 o'clock hour. Is there anybody else that would like to add anything, ask questions? Do you have any good comments that you'd like to make? I don't think we're going to go for a mandatory 3 or 4 hour meeting today. But definitely check out the ProdigyFK website later, throughout this week and into next weekend. There'll be a lot of new things added. You'll be able to sign up for the next journey meeting. And don't forget to sign up for tickets to the student symposium that's going to be held April 12th and 13th. Brian, go ahead. You want to throw something in?
Well, thanks. Bob, thanks for the plug of the book. We, Gary and I and Ricky, put in a lot of sweat hours putting that together. And as of yesterday, we have a few typos that we saw that we're going to fix in the second printing. So don't freak out when you see a wrong date. So we had six pairs of eyes looking at it for over 3 months. So invariably something was going to get caught. As of yesterday, our publisher informed us that we've had almost 700 copies sold. So that's very encouraging for us. We didn't think we'd get that many, but I'm glad we're still. The story is still of an interest, and so I just wanted to thank Bob for for the plug. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, 700, over 700 copies. That's pretty good because it's been available for pre-order since, what was it, Brian? November was pre-order? October?
Yeah, the pre-order was at the conference. That was in November. And we had it available on Amazon. We didn't know it was going to be on Amazon, but apparently the printer automatically does that. So it's available at Barnes & Noble, through Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and then through our website, or through the publisher's website.
Yeah, and you can visit the prodigyfk.com website, and you'll be able to obviously the book is available there, and it'll be a direct link. The first link I put up did not go to the website, Brian. It went to a 404 unfound, so I'm going to redo it again. We were having internet problems with the storms and stuff here in Kansas City, so I will try that again to get the link back up there where they can just click on the cover or a button to order it. Also, Larry Rivera's book, the new digital 2023 edition of the JFK Horseman, is available on our website for purchase as well. Ron, you've got your hand up. You want to throw something in?
Hi. I was wondering if you could maybe have Max Good, who did the assassination of Ruth Payne, the assassination of JFK. I found his documentary to be pretty interesting and share. She lives about an hour and a half away up in Santa Rosa from where I live. I thought it was
what did you say his name was?
Max Good.
Max Good. That's the 14-year-old, right?
No,
that is an author.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking of it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Max Good, he did the assassination in Ruth Payne, I think the title was, or I have it backwards, but he interviewed Ruth Payne about the Lee Harvey Oswald and everything.
And was that a documentary that was on, on Amazon Prime or one of the
yeah, services? Yeah.
Okay. Right. I did see the documentary, but I'm sorry, I didn't know the name.
Yeah. I thought it was a pretty compelling thing. I didn't believe her, but she was, I thought it was well presented. I thought it was pretty balanced, but was not very impressed with her. She, to me, looks like a very covert CIA agent.
Just wanted to say, my colleague, Brian Backus, who helps me, is close with Max, and he worked with Max on the film. And if you need any help with anything on that front, let me know. I've interviewed Ruth twice. So, yeah. Yeah, she's very studied.
We put her in a lie, and we think we have seen she seems to have a tick when she lies. Max unfortunately did not pursue the question, but he asked her in the documentary whether Oliver Stone had ever been in contact with her. She said no, and in fact, I had asked Oliver Stone at the 2013 program at the Wecht Institute why the Paynes were the only major character in the movie whose names were changed. They were called the Williams in the movie. And he said that the Paynes had threatened to sue him and the media company if they had used their name. So her statement that she never heard from Oliver Stone is at least legalistic and likely was a lie, because maybe Max should have said, well, did any of your representatives have a conversation with Oliver Stone? But he did not know. Again, he's not a journalist like Russ. And so he didn't. That's another example, unfortunately, where some people aren't very skilled in doing follow-up questions. It's a little frustrating, but that's the way life is.
Thank you, Larry. Anybody else would you like to add something?
I just want to add that I did read the entire book, which is quite voluminous, Under Cover of Darkness. I'm wondering if anybody else is out there getting a copy It is it has some valuable information in it. It's very much an attack on David Lifton, and the author, who's I have it here, but I'm not going to hold it up. It's a two-volume work of over 1,000 pages, and there are nevertheless it's overwritten in some parts, and there are certainly some major criticisms that can be made absolutely about the style of the book. But it goes into, in particular, the role of the Air Force, or members of, you know, former Air Force members. And he took the trouble to go and interview a number of these people. And most of the interviews appear to have occurred around between about 2013 and 2015. Excuse me. But it represents a lot of work. There are, it's very flawed, very flawed. But nevertheless, it is not incongruous. That is to say, it is congruent with the position, which I found jaw-dropping to the extent it was endorsed by John Newman, who I considered the gold standard of researchers, at the Pittsburgh conference. And Larry was there. I don't know how many others of you were at the Pittsburgh conference, but he used the C word, which was coup d'etat. John Newman did at that conference. And of course, when you think of a coup d'etat and Joint Chiefs, you know, the name Curtis LeMay comes to mind. And there's a significant amount of information about LeMay, and also about his sort of right-hand man, Powers. Or I'm not sure if it's Power or Powers, the number two man with Sack. And it's interesting. You have to really take it with a grain of salt, a lot of it. But he goes into some detail about the issue of the two coffins at the autopsy. So he seizes on that, but he's very vitriolic in condemning Lifton. And the book couldn't have been published during Lifton's lifetime. But nevertheless, it's interesting. It's probably for the hardcore completist, in the sense that it's expensive and it's over 1,000 pages.
Could you repeat the name and author, please?
Yeah, it's called Undercover of Darkness.
Sean Fetter.
Yes, Fetter.
I wrote both volumes myself.
Oh, you did?
And I don't know how to describe. It's interesting. I'll give you that. The style. I wanted to like punch him, you know.
Yeah.
But it's one of those where there's a lot. There's some interesting things there.
Yeah.
But there's a lot that like, and he claims it's the next book. I'm like, well, you better really you better put up or shut up in this next book, because it kept me reading. Let me just put it that way.
There's a huge red flag in the book where he says, "Oh, I'm coming out with my next book very soon.
Right.
And it's going to be a real blockbuster, but I can't tell you what the secrets are."
Yeah, right.
So that's
we've heard that before, haven't we?
Yeah, that's a big red flag.
It is. Rick, you had your hand up, Rick.
I have a question for Larry Rivera. Hey, Larry, how you doing? I watched the new JFK show, and the last show you did with the streaming video of the Zapruder film was a great show. And I was wondering, can you do that same process with the next film?
The streaming?
Yeah, where you had the...
Oh, yeah, right. Yes. We create a data stream, not specifically frame numbers. And what we do is we put in a special software, and we run it, and we detect exactly where one frame rolls into the next. Possibly which one? The next?
The next. I was wondering if from the opposite side you could get the next film and see what that shows.
I understand what you're saying.
Those images... Those images were so clear in the stream as they broke down. It was amazing, the detail.
And yeah, and well, some people loved it. Some people, not some, just a couple of people, made the comment that that was just digital, you know, and that. But you know, some of the things that we see there by doing that, for example, the second agent in the car, and all that airbrushing that we see in the in some of the frames. Trying to hide the fact that a second Secret Service agent jumped into the limo, and that's progressed pretty good there on that front.
It was a great show. It was interesting, and and I you know, it was so interesting. I was wondering if it could be used on other films to either verify or refute what's going on in the Z film. So, just an idea.
Well, just now, the digital age allows us to break down film and images. For example, what David did with the Ultra 6, you know, that we presented here a couple of times. It's amazing how you can zoom in on the image when you have the original, the quote-unquote, the original negative. All right, so, we'll look into that. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Speaking of Larry, since you're right here with me, we haven't heard a lot from you today. Would you like to add some new stuff, especially that photograph you got behind the on the wall behind you?
Absolutely. This came from the back cover of Dateline Dallas, and let me just I used to subscribe to Dateline Dallas. Okay, I have about 6 or 7 of them here, but I do not have the one that that shows that photo in the background. We're trying to find with Gary, since he was the publisher, or he was involved with the old Assassination Information Center in downtown Dallas, and they're the one who published this journal, this publication here. And we're trying to find the provenance of that image, because it shows when it unequivocally we've determined a Cuban, quote-unquote, fist-pumping man next to the umbrella man on Elm Street there with his little beret and his jacket and everything. And the both images, if you compare to the man, there's several images of him. After the assassination, he's looking down Elm Street. And if you look at that, maybe I'll just put this on the chat there in a second, where the crease of the jacket is exactly the same, all right? The glasses, the profile, the ear, and they match Orlando Bosch, okay? And a lot of people know that Orlando Bosch traveled to Dallas in that two-car caravan with Marita Lorenz, Sturgis, okay, the Noble brothers, Patrick Hamming, and Pedro Diaz-Lanz, who was a pilot who defected from Cuba. And he was the first one that came before a congressional subcommittee denouncing that Castro was really a communist, okay. So this team an individual who Marita identified as Ozzy. But the point of this here is that Orlando Bosch is in that caravan, and then we see him on Elm Street doing what he did, and then he also has a walkie-talkie device there that he's talking into. And so, you know, it's him. We've identified it as him. Now, the audacity of him appearing at Parkland there, you know, taking in the scene and, you know, how this happened, how this could have happened, because he had just been on Elm Street and then now he's in Parkland, you know, doing this, you know. He appears to have some kind of like camera strap around his neck, you know, like maybe he was passing as a photographer, as a journalist. But we're trying to get the original of this. If anybody has seen this picture, let me put it up here real quick, just a second. You can go ahead and talk while I do this.
let's try this out because this is going to be a test on the sharing since I had to turn it off a while ago. Try to hit share and then let's see if that pops up a bubble on my side.
Okay, just a second. Let's turn on the please.
Hey, you look different. What happened? What's different?
Who?
You, Black. Who is that just putting his glasses on?
Oh, that was Neil.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's not Larry.
hold on. We got that here.
Another thing I want to throw out, anybody that is in the room, when you come in, make sure, I mean, sometimes it comes in, it shows like a phone number, it may show iPhone, iPad, Android, whatever. You can click in the participants page at the bottom of your screen and you'll pull up and you'll see your name. It's three little dots next to it. It says, you know, change your name. Please change your name so that way if it's a phone number or if it says iPad or iPhone or Android or something else other than what was actually, you know, your name, it's hard to tell sometimes who the bad actors are in the room. I'm trying to get J. Yuri Shaw to be able to come back in with his audio and video, and I didn't know which one was him. I kind of figured it was either iPad or iPhone, but yeah, when you come into a meeting, just, you know, change your name to your name, and unless it, you know, most everybody's got the right, you know, the right name that pops up, but there are some, and those are usually the ones that, you know, I start looking at as suspect. I know Gary always logs in like that, but some of the other ones like we had today, those are some of the bad actors we had earlier. So
you're not asking us to change our real names to our doppelganger, right?
No, definitely just, you know, like where it pops up, it says Larry Snap. Hey, guess what? I know who you are. If it says like a 555 number, I have no idea who the hell you are. So you get it done there, Larry?
Yeah, it's in the chat.
Oh, you got it in the chat. Okay. Did you want to show that on the screen?
Yeah, you want to? Yeah, go ahead.
All right, let me just click sec. All right, now try to share.
Oh, you want me to share it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So here, these are the top right are confirmed photos of Orlando Bosch. Anybody ever heard of him? He is one of the most virulent anti.
Double, hey Larry, double click on that photograph because the only name we see is just your file explorer.
You don't see the photo?
No, the photo is just a thumbnail at the moment. Oh. Double click on your thumbnail and see if it pulls it up on the screen.
Let me try it again. How's that? No?
I got you now. Go ahead.
Okay. Got it?
Yep.
Okay. Known photos of Orlando Bosch at the top right. Okay. The fist pumping individual who's right there on the off of the curb of Elm Street in front of the Umbrella Man. You see him here down at the bottom. After the assassination, they both sit on the curb. Everybody, who studied this knows about this. He's talking on a walkie-talkie device, and then he puts it in his back pocket. You can see it here on the where I have the mouse hovering around. And this is the image. This is a photograph that's on the back cover of that Dateline Dallas. And here he is. So we flip the image. There was another one from one of the photos on 22nd November. That were taken, and you see him here, a good profile. This one has been cleaned up quite a bit here, and it's a pretty high probability, I would say 95%, that this is Orlando Bosch. So when we flip the image here and we compare it to this guy here, and you can see one of the most interesting features here, you see the crease here on the jacket, it looks like a Z. You go down here, it's the same one. All right. right here, where I have the two red squares and the arrow here. Okay, so that's a pretty good identifier there if I were looking into this here. And now the implications here are just mind-boggling. You know, what was this guy doing? Not, well, obviously what he did. We know what he did on Elm Street. But then he ends up here in Parkland. All right, so interesting things that come out. We're still trying to find the provenance, and probably from one of the newspapers, maybe the Times Herald or whatever, Dallas Morning News, whatever. That's something that I thought I should share. Another, I just wanted to make a comment on the FBI, because I've had my nose in the files since they came out in 2017, and still have them, believe it or not. This is something that's going to take years to sort through. But what I have found to be very consistent has been that the one agency that has really stonewalled researchers and the production of documents has been the FBI. And we saw it when I talked about the passport thing last meeting, which, I mean, how egregious can that be? Well, we have even the receipt signed by Warren DeBrew on 26 November that he took possession of the passport, of both passport books. Only one of them makes it into the Warren Commission. The other one was lost until we found it at the North Texas repository, North Texas State University repository, where we found the one passport that was missing. And I have so many examples of documents from the FBI that you read through the document, and then all of a sudden, the next page is missing. Okay, there's a document that I've been after, a 40-page document regarding Warren DeBrew in October, okay, October 25, and it talks about all these informants that were informing on Lee Oswald, okay, in September and October. Well, these are the supposed dates that he went to Mexico City. Okay, that's why this passport thing had to be completely buried, you know, because once you look at the passport and it says clearly that you cannot go to Cuba on this passport, then this whole Mexico City house of cards comes tumbling down. All right? So this one document I've been after, it's only got the introduction, the first two pages. It mentions all at least five informants that filed reports, but then the next pages are completely irrelevant, have nothing to do with the introduction that Warren DeBrew writes about, okay, and who he talks about and who is reporting to him and everything. So I just wanted to throw that out there that of all the agencies, I would say that even the CIA, you know, has been more forthcoming, you know, about documents, ladies and gentlemen. And it's been the FBI, the one that's really, really at the top of the list here on suppressing documents.
Yeah, and they also had the same attitude towards the ARB. They're the only agency that actually filed petitions with the president, the Office of the President, to hold back documents. So the FBI, and that's probably because the FBI does domestic security issues. The CIA is supposed to be only overseas. So they're the domestic, they probably do a lot of CIA's dirty work in the country. So it's not surprising that the FBI would be the agency that fights back. And they've always used the law enforcement exemption of the FOIA, even if there's no active investigation, enforcement, they use that as a basis to they keep the thing open, and they say it's an open law enforcement, and that's the excuse they use to hide the records.
There you go.
All right. Thank you, Larry. I'm trying. Let's see here. Norman, you got your hand up. What would you like to add?
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good.
I put it in the chat, so and I can't do it justice because it's really complicated, but there was a folk singer, Jim Glover. He was very close to Phil Oakes, and he's alive. He's down in Florida. He was in Texas, he was part of the Hootenanny tour, and he claims that he was being used. Well, like I said, I can't do it justice, but he was there. He said Oakes was there in Dallas. Phil Oakes had prior knowledge through his dad about the assassination beforehand. And that so the point is, you mentioned document requests that Mr. Glover actually did petition the FBI for his documents. He made a FOIA request, and he said that in 1993, the FBI director wrote him that the Tampa office had it, and but he still has not gotten it. That, I think, was where it was left. But anyway, he has. If you go, apparently there's a book, Phil Oakes and the Crucifixion of President John F. Kennedy, that might provide some background. I have not read that, but I'm on his Facebook page. I know him through that, and he's attended JFK Facts, Larry, and he's a subscriber, I think.
I just want to note, and I've spoken to him several times over the years. His story, you should all know, is that the Hootenanny tour bus stopped at some point, and that J. Edgar Hoover and George H.W. Bush got on the bus. And at that point, I thought, okay, I'm not so sure about this.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, I'm not saying that that's true, but he did say he submitted this FBI report. So I don't know if that in any way would be a you know.
I mean, does anybody believe that J. Edgar Hoover was in Dallas at the time and, you know, doing anything in public, much less would he ever have gotten on a Hootenanny tour bus anywhere, ever?
Yeah, like I said, I'm not talking about the veracity of that, but, you know, he was a prominent folk singer at that time, and he was, you know, touring. He went to Ohio State University with Phil Oakes, so that relationship is established. So, you know, whether or not the rest of the story is true or not, I'm not saying, but, you know, he certainly says that, you know, he certainly was someone who was there at the time and knew Phil Oakes. So that's all I'm saying. So I don't know more than that. I can't put anything in the chat. I'm on my phone, so I would share.
Anybody okay. That you know, looked, maybe bypassed it in the chat log. It was at the two twenty-five p.m. is when the link was put in there by Norman. So if anybody wants to go back there and look at that, it's in the chat log at 2:25 p.m.
Well, that was about Dorothy Kilgallen. I put a link in there from Covert Action Magazine. They just wrote a new article about that, which I thought was very good, based on the journalist Shaw's his work. So that's separate. But
oh, okay.
I can't put Glover's link in here because it's a I'm on my phone and I can't get it up here with that in the moment. But apparently he has he has his report. He has some kind of document that supposedly documents that he made this request. I can't share it because I can't get into Microsoft from my phone.
Okay. Well, thank you, Norman, for sharing that. We're trying to get Gary Shaw. He's having some issues with his audio. He wants to share a couple things, but we're having a hard time getting him to be able to unmute and join in. So we're gonna vamp for a little bit. I always like to hear what Gary has to say. Would anybody else like to add something or ask a question?
I've read a couple books about Phil Oakes, and I don't recall hearing that story in either of them. I don't also remember hearing about Hoover being much of a folk singer.
I heard he was a good dancer, though.
Interpretive dance.
Well, he was probably there with Johnny Roselli.
All right. Well, again, we're gonna keep going here. Hopefully, Gary will be able to get in.
Neil, can I make a couple of comments, please?
Yeah, go ahead, Neil. Our friend across the pond.
Hope you're okay, David. I didn't get a chance to interject when the guys were talking about Ruth Payne. I had the misfortune to see one of her lectures last November in Dallas in Irving, on the 20th of November. It really was a shambles. There was about a half a dozen of us from Dealey Plaza UK that attended. Jeff Meek was there, the Grodens were there, and there was a bunch of low nutters there as well. Johnny Cairns has recently put together a really good article, which he's posted at Kennedy's and King, which I would recommend that you go and look at. Basically, you know, debunking pretty much everything she said at this lecture. And also, he has just appeared on a Lena Sarnick podcast on Black Op Radio. It's a really good, it's about an hour and change, and it's a really good appearance as a guest. And I would recommend that people listen to that as well, because it really was a really poor show. To be honest with you, I think we were close to walking out. It was so poor. But you know, she's in her mid 90s, and we felt that we probably shouldn't do that. But the actual lecture's been posted, I think, on YouTube as well. If anybody's interested, I don't think you should really watch it, but it's just a cluster.
I saw you there, and she was, for those who don't know, this was put on by the Irving Arts Center, and it was Ruth Payne in conversation with Thomas Mallon, the author of Mrs. Payne's Garage.
Oh, God.
It's a nice, slim book. And I did ask Ruth a question, and I was surprised, because you had to write your questions on cards, and then they were all filtered by Mr. Mallon. But he did ask her my question. I have to try to remember what it was, but I remember she paused for a moment. So I want to go back and have a look at that.
Yeah, I mean, it was bad. It was bad stuff for us, wasn't it? I mean, obviously he was acting as the gatekeeper, just shuffling through those questions. My question actually wasn't my question. It was Brooks's question. Because I was talking to Brooks a couple of days beforehand in Dallas, and I can't remember. I think I asked him, did Michael Payne ever have a gun? But obviously that got filtered and didn't get asked.
The thing that's interesting about her is, does anybody remember many people throughout history who knew somebody accused of a crime that was unlike anything they had ever done before, who immediately and enthusiastically said that they probably had done it? The only case I remember was in the, if you recall, the Boston Marathon bombing case, these two young men, the Tsarnaev brothers, who had no track record of any kind of violent acts. Their uncle called a press conference to say that he was sure they had done it, and he, by the way, had been married to the daughter of a top CIA person. So I thought that was very interesting. Sorry, I didn't mean to stump everyone with that one. I just think it's unusual, to say the least. Usually what you see is they interview the neighbor of the mass murderer who says, oh, he seemed like a perfectly nice guy. I mean, nobody ever says, oh, you know, I know he never did anything, but I always suspected he might be, whatever. That's very, very rare, especially the closer you are to the person, and particularly when they lived in your house. It's very unusual you would say, yes, they lived in my house, and yes, I do think that this is the kind of person who would have shot the president.
Yeah, because then that raises the question, like, well, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you tell the police? It would be very unusual for persons to admit that they were negligent, with someone like that.
Hey, I think Gary, I see his microphone unmuted. Gary, are you with us now?
I went crazy, but I'm on.
Hey, whatever you did that time, it worked. Go ahead, yeah. Gary.
Jay was really working hard on Gary.
Well, we've been trying to get him in for like the last 30, 45 minutes, so.
When you're technically challenged, you know, you do the best you can. I wanted to tell Bob, thanks for putting the plug in a while ago. I wanted to share something with you real quick, because the book is already doing some things that we really were asking people to do, and that is to try to identify the unidentified people that Roscoe White placed in this scrapbook of his. And one of the came from an unusual place, from my nephew, by the way, and he's been interested in this over the years, so he was anxious to get the book and did. And on page 189 of the book, can you see this? This is just a Xerox copy of it. All right, there is a masculine-looking woman is the top photograph. We came up with, or at least I came up with an idea of a female impersonator who was in and out of the My Oh My Club in New Orleans named Harvey Goodwin. He went by, his stage name was the Fabulous Mr. Harvey Lee. Can you believe that? So anyway, I identified that picture that I just showed you as being possibly that person. I just found out who it really was, and it's this lady right here. It's the very same picture. It's been cropped in the Roscoe White book, but here it is in a news photograph from 1941. The person is the most wealthy, the wealthiest lady in the world at that time, Doris Duke, D-U-K-E. Isn't that something? Well, she married a guy in 1947 named Ruby Rosa, R-U-B-I-R-O-S-A. And he was living in Paris, but he was also a close buddy and an associate of Trujillo down in the Dominican, and was known as an assassin and rumored to be an assassin. He died in 1965. After the assassination, he was like, you know, maybe 61 at the time. So it's a very interesting and intriguing little connection that we hadn't come across before. But FBI documents in 1963 of June were talking about this man meeting up with Giancana in Paris. So I'm in the early stages of research, but that's what I've found so far. We've got others that need positive identification. This is one of them that we were looking to identify. So if y'all want to run with that, please do. That's what we've been asking you to do.
Well, all right, thank you. Let me make sure I got this straight. So it is a woman. It's not a a male drag queen.
Right.
And she was married to an assassin. Is that what I understood?
That's right.
All right. Do you have any idea what's your opinion so far as to why that would be in the book?
Well, I don't. But it's very unusual. Roscoe White, a farm boy from Arkansas in Dallas, Texas, in 19, whenever he put that in that scrapbook, why he would put that photograph in there. Your guess is as good as mine, but my suspicion is there's a connection.
And what was her name again, please?
Doris, D-O-R-I-S, D-U-K-E, last name Duke. Okay. She was an heir of a very prominent tobacco man. That's where her wealth came from.
Okay. Joe, you've got your hand up. Do you have a question for J. Gary Shaw on this matter?
No, but could I go back to Larry Rivera on that?
Yeah, let me put you on hold for just a second. I want to talk to Gary about a couple of things here real quick.
Well, I just have a follow-up. Gary, could you based on where you are today, how do you see this thread that you're pulling on connected with Roscoe White? I mean, if it's what you're suggesting, he would have had to known this, maybe this imposter, not imposter, but impersonator, and also maybe, another.
No, my guess work was wrong when I wrote the book and wrote that up. I had traced that down to the possibility, because of the name Harvey. The Fabulous Mr. Harvey Lee was his stage name, and he had a strong resemblance to the photograph that's in the scrapbook. But my nephew found out who the photograph was and actually found the original news photo, and it's Doris Duke. So
now, Gary,
it's one of those strange connections. But when you and I'm in the very early stages of researching the lady, and she has connections. I mean, when you've got Sam Giancana in June of 1963 meeting with the guy in Paris, and he's a rumored to be or is said to have been an assassin working directly with Trujillo and the Dominican Republic. That's interesting. How would Roscoe White connect to that? I don't have any idea. But he was known to have been killing people. That was his confession. He was known to kill people.
Was her husband the Rubricio, something like that?
Ruby Rosa.
Yeah, he's a he was a diplomat for Dominican Republic.
Officially, yeah. Diplomat. Yeah. Officially, that's yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, Gary, in the small type on the vertical side of that photograph, does it say what newspaper that was that photograph was used in?
No, it doesn't, but it has LA1, so I'm assuming that's Los Angeles, and it's an AP photograph, wire photo, from November 21st, 1941.
Hey, Gary?
Yes.
Gary, it's Russ.
Hey, Russ.
Yeah, hey. By the way, if you say LA1, that might I can't see it, but that one might actually be a T, and that would stand for LA Times.
Okay. It could be, but it looks more like a 1, and it's in parentheses. It starts out the whole description of the photograph. It's an AP wire photo, and
what was the date on that? November, what was it, 1941?
No. November 21, 1941.
Okay.
She's divorced a guy named James H.R. Cromwell.
Right.
Just a quick comment. Her name popped up somewhere back quite a few years ago as I was doing some research, and I can't remember the context, but she was very prominent in Newport, Rhode Island society,
yes.
And she knew Jackie Kennedy.
Yes, she knew Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah.
She is very well connected in those circles.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm just in the early stages of taking a real close look at her, but there's a lot of information on her. Talbot wrote about him briefly in one of his books. Let me see. It's the Devil's Cross.
Devil's Chessboard.
The Devil's Chessboard, yeah. And he didn't have a whole lot to say, but he did talk about him and his connections.
He was a
big... it's a lead, you know. I mean, if Roscoe White was, as he claimed and admitted, an assassin, you know, he may have had connections to this particular...
Her husband, yeah. Ruby Rosso, was a big supporter of Trujillo.
Trujillo, really. This guy was supposedly a big lover boy. You know, he was well endowed, so to speak, and that was his reputation as being a lover boy. He married Betty Hutton or went with Betty Hutton. And, you know, I mean, he's quite a character. Race car driver. He died in 65 running his car into a tree.
Single car accident, Gary?
Yeah.
Put a blurb from Wikipedia on her brief marriage to him in the chat.
Well, see, I kudos goes out. You said that was your nephew that that was able
yeah.
to...
Yeah, Lake Shaw. I'm real proud of him. He's followed this with me all through the years, but never this kind of interest. And for him to pop up with that a couple of weeks after he gets his book, you know, it was a nice surprise.
Well, Tony, thank you from the research community, especially the ones here in attendance. It just goes to show that, you know, even somebody that, you know, doesn't have a huge interest like some of us do, you know, missing pieces can be found, even after publications of books and years of, you know, speculation. But I'm glad we now have a name to go with the person, and it sounds like it's going to open up a whole new can of worms to go down the rabbit hole of, you know, connections and who this woman was. So
it may be nothing, but the picture had to have been in there for some reason.
Right, and absolutely.
There are three or four others that we tentatively, or we say this possibly could be, or this kind of looks like so and so and so and so, but we've never identified about three or four or five people in the scrapbook with positive identification. And that's the reason we put the book out primarily, is there's a lot of things we don't know. There are things that we know and we print those, but there's a whole lot we don't. So,
well, let me ask you, have you told Ricky that you now have an identification on one of those photographs in the book?
I told Brian, but I just now told y'all.
Well, be very interested to know if, you know, what his thoughts on. I mean, it's the nice aspect, like you said, you know, putting the book out there and, you know, getting the armchair detectives to kick in, and your nephew being one of them. Tell him to get to work on the other three. We'd like to have some names.
I've already told him that. I've told him that. So.
Her papers are at Duke University. In case anyone wants to take, if anyone's nearby. And by the way, she was born on November 22nd.
That's right.
Wow. Okay, that's.
I got you guys looking already. That's what I wanted.
Yeah, I already have it in my search box. I started looking. I was trying to find that exact same photograph. I haven't come across it yet, but I'm looking for it.
By the way, her dad was the founder of American Tobacco Company and Duke Energy.
Yep.
No, that agree much. That anyone depends upon Wikipedia, you might just be intrigued as a human interest part of it to look up Porfirio Rubirosa.
Yeah.
His connections to Doris Duke are interesting, but his connections to the entire world are not even implied by Gary's comments. This guy was quite a character, and I'm intrigued by his diplomatic status as well. But this guy, Rubirosa.
Let me hold this up for you right quick. This came off of Mary Farrell. Can you see me?
Try to move it a little closer to the center there.
Okay. This is an FBI document. It's dated June 11th. Of 63, where they're talking about Giancana. This is from the SAC Chicago to Hoover, and talking about him meeting, Giancana meeting with this Rubirosa when he goes to Paris the next month or thereabout. So there's more documents, but I've not looked at them. Okay.
Hey, Gary, there's something in her papers about Castro versus Duke. Do you know what that's about?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I'm just started, Larry.
Well, now we're gonna be on the trail with you, Gary.
Well, I think it's an important lead, how that country boy would have known anything about why would he have put this picture if there was not some connection to what he had been doing.
Well, that's everybody's homework to investigate and help Gary. We'll talk about this again on the 6th of April. But I'm glad that the one of the ideas of the book of getting identifications has panned out. This is very exciting.
Great, thank you guys.
Thank you, Gary. I'm glad we were able to get you in.
Thanks. Finally.
Yes. I've been vamping and holding on. I was like, I got it. It's important. I got to hear what you have to say. So
yeah.
I'm glad it was worth the wait and the hassle of the electronics that, you know, electronics are great until they don't work.
Yeah.
I was going to say I was a little disappointed. I was really delving into the connection between the cross-dresser and J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah.
But now I guess I'll have to drop that.
You know, it's interesting. The relevant legal and the all her correspondence and legal documents, you have to get permission from the Duke Foundation to review these. Although they list what they are, you need to have permission from the Duke Foundation to review them.
That's very odd that, you know, you got to have the special permission. Usually, I mean, obviously, you know, it's her papers going to the university, but you would think since university took the possession of those papers, anybody that, you know, wanted to go in there and look at it should be able to go in and see it. But
requires prior written approval from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation to access these materials.
She must have set something up, or the family set something up when they donated the gift of those records.
There's clearly a gift, a deed of gift that puts real type restrictions.
Yeah. That's very, very interesting. Even with, you know, donating your papers to a university, I know there's several researchers that their papers, you know, whether they were alive or have already passed, have donated their papers to universities or to organizations. And unfortunately, either sometimes, you know, things are not digitized in this day and age. They sit in the cold rooms for decades. I know Russell's collection was the same way. But yeah, unless you know where to look, and now I guess, you know, even someone would have to have, you know, authorization to see them. I guess Duke thinks that they're an offshoot of NARA. Got to have permission to go in and see things. So,
hey Gary, when did she supposedly have communications with Marcello? I know the document you said was from
not Marcello. Giancana.
Oh, Giancana. Okay.
She's not having communication with him. Ruby Rosa is meeting with him in June in Paris.
June of what year?
63.
Oh. Well, that's interesting.
I'm very intrigued by that photograph being in the Roscoe White Green Book. I mean, that raises all kinds of questions in my opinion.
Well, where did he come from? Where did he find that? Was it in a later newspaper article or in a, you know, one of those magazines or, you know, I don't know. But for my nephew to have found it online, it's, by the way, found in historical images. I don't know whether y'all ever go to the historical image site or not, but it's a good site to go to if you're trying to find old photographs.
What is it called?
Historical Images.
Mm.
Now, if somebody has facial ID identification software, you know, we might do something like that. I don't, and that's above my pay grade.
Well, all right. Well, let's see here. We're going past the 3 o'clock hour, coming up on the 4 o'clock, at least in my time, central. But does anybody else have anything that they would like to add or share or ask?
Me.
Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry, I was going to come back to you. That's right. Please, go ahead, Joe.
Okay. The guy, Larry, says he had two different images, and he's saying they're the same person. They're not. They're dressed very similarly, but they are indeed two different people. One of them actually is a photographer. You will see him at Love Field when JFK arrives. And the photograph he's asking about at Parkland, if you have the book by Robert McNeil, 1963, The Way We Were, 1963, the year Kennedy was shot, a large trade paperback. That photo was on page 197.
Are you able to share your screen and show us that, Joe?
Hold on.
Some people may not have access to that publication.
Can I say something?
Hold on.
Can I say something? You might you might look online. There's a there's a whole series of photographs taken by a photographer by the name of Miller. These are color photographs. They were
exactly. Yep.
They were put into they were put into card form and sold as a set.
Yeah, a dozen of them as a postcards called "Lest We Forget."
Right.
Yeah. He's also in there at Love Field.
Right.
So hold on a second.
While Joe's working on that, Gary, I want to ask you, we were talking about this at dinner the other night. I was speaking to Larry Rivera on the phone about it. Do you have the back issues of Dateline Dallas in your repository?
Yes, sir.
Is there a way that we could, I mean, you were part of that publication, correct?
Right, that's correct. When you get through with all your schoolwork, I've got a batch of material that needs to go on there. I've got all of Penn Jones's newsletters, Gary Mack's newsletters before he went south on us, Joaquin Yostin's newsletters from very early on, and all of these need to be online.
I was wanting to digitize, especially, I mean, I only saw Dateline Dallas one issue, and I think it was back when I went down there in 91. But yeah, I just once
there
are
several issues.
Talking to
there weren't a lot of issues, but there were several, and I have them. Yes.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I think you know, they're not digitized anyplace else. I mean, third and fourth decade, you can find. I know you can find those. I think at Mary Farrell, at least the third decade. I'm not for sure about the fourth.
I've got a lot of early stuff like that needs to be online. I've got a little, kind of a little magazine that was put out in '67 by Bill Boxley, I think was responsible for it, William Wood.
Uh-huh.
And it has a whole list of the characters that were engaged with the Garrison affair down there and descriptions of the people. And, you know, I saw one on an auction site and it was selling for $1,500. I need to put it online so that, you know, everybody can have that sucker.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think that would be a worthwhile endeavor that we can take on to digitize and make it available. I mean, unless you have those someplace in your personal archives as a researcher, I mean, you're not, they're no place else to be found. So, yeah, let's definitely look at that. I see Joe's got his screen shared here.
Can you see?
I can see where it says Zoom in the middle of your screen, but I'm not seeing the photograph. You're almost there, I can tell.
Hi, Joe.
Hello. Let's see. Can you see it, that?
Yeah. No, I'm still seeing the Zoom screen. I see your bookmarks on the left side. Okay, I'm seeing some stuff come up now. Depends on what window you're going to pop up on there for us.
See you holding the book up in your thumbnail for the call, but we don't see it on the screen that you're sharing. No, I think the host can just make Joe's thumbnail the main screen for everybody, I believe.
Yeah, go ahead and show that up on the screen. Let me pin you and see if that will work here. Let me pin you to the screen. Okay, I see the car.
I think
okay, yeah, there's a good photograph of it.
Penn only works for your screen, David. It doesn't force our screens to change. So,
Joe, say something. Everybody else be quiet.
Hello.
There we go.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello.
We see you.
You see me?
Yeah.
Yeah, hold the picture back up and then just say something.
I have a suggestion. Can he take a picture of it and send it to you, David, and then you get it onto the Zoom?
Joe, can you take a quick picture of that with your cell phone and send it to me?
Yep. Let's see.
Okay, the way we were.
Will do.
Okay, yeah, go ahead and work on that and send me that photograph. Email it to me at projectjfk@yahoo.com. And while you're doing that, we'll continue here. That's in much better quality than the one that Larry had. That of course that was taken off the back of was that I think Larry said that was Dateline Dallas the back cover.
David and Gary, I'm retired now, and if I can do anything to help digitize Gary's files, if he's willing to do it, I could dedicate a week to help you do that. I don't know if a week is enough time or how Gary would feel about it, but I'd be willing to try to help.
Well, let me ask you real quick here. What kind of equipment do you have to do scanning with, Rick?
I really don't have anything other than my phone, but if I could rent equipment or anything to help you out, I'd be willing to do it.
Okay, yeah. I know phones are great for some things, but you know, when it comes to the documents to make them into PDF, mm-hmm. especially searchable, you kind of have to have one of the machines like what I have and what Brian Edwards has.
My comment to you, David, for the information is I have a Canon 8800 flatbed. It's 9600 DPI.
That doesn't help me much. I'm not willing to put a lot of this stuff and trust the mail or.
Right. We go down in person and do it like we've done before.
Yeah.
That's correct.
That's what I was saying. I'd be willing to do it. I live in San Antonio. So if there was something I could do to help David while you're in school and Gary, if you're willing to do it, I'd be willing to dedicate the time to help. So.
Well, I appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. We'll see what we can do with that.
Here, just let me know.
All right. Let me check my email and see if I have that photograph yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Well, for the people that are still watching this at home on YouTube, which will be uploaded tomorrow, we have our next journey meeting coming up on April the 6th at 1 o'clock. Tickets will cease at noon Central Time. And then we'll also we also have the information up for the student symposium at Johns County Community College. That's going to be on April the 12th through the 13th. So definitely want to check out the new tab on the Project JFK website, JCC Student Symposium, and you can purchase your tickets online there to attend the event, whether you're in person or online. I do want to throw this out. If you are a student and you want to buy a student discounted ticket for the Zoom, you do need to email me at projectjfk@yahoo.com. I need a photocopy, or you can take it with your cell phone, of your student ID in order to get that discount. I want to just make sure that nobody is, you know, it's kind of on the honor system, but we don't want to have somebody, you know, paying the student fee if they're not a student. That's reserved strictly for the students to use to access to get in. So make sure you email before you make your purchase on the Zoom portion for students. Everybody else, it's $50 whether you come in person or you do it on Zoom. I'd love to have as many people to come in person because guess what? The more people that are our age and older, you're going to get a chance to interact with younger people. Now, these are people that, you know, maybe haven't studied like what we have. So getting the chance to come up and talk to a person face-to-face as a seasoned researcher with the work that you've done, that would be a lot better than, you know, just trying to talk to him on Zoom, because most people won't have the ability while they're trying to watch the rest of the conference presentations. So anybody that can come in person, please do. And it's definitely cheaper than going to Dallas, although we don't want you to not to go to Dallas. We're going to do a Dallas conference this November. So this here is a little bit on the cheaper scale. And, hey, we're in the Midwest, so we're kind of in the center of the United States. Maybe a cheaper airfare, or if you're close enough, you can drive. You know, come up and get some great Kansas City barbecue. You know, be on a college campus again or for the first time, and share your insight with the younger generation. Those are the ones that, you know, are going to take this over one day when, you know, let's face it, we're all mortal, and we're all going to shuffle off this court one time in the future. So we want to make sure that, you know, we get people with fresh eyes and fresh minds involved in this.
Hopefully those are on their way to you, Dave.
I am refreshing right now. Yep, I got them. Okay.
Why did the thing get so small?
Okay. Let me do a quick share screen here on my end. And let me bring it up so we can see it. Okay. You should be seeing the email now. This is the photograph that Larry Rivera was showing earlier. This is a book copy, much better quality. We can see that he's got a camera. Looks like
he's got several cameras.
I was gonna say it looks like at least two I can see.
Yeah, he's a real photographer.
Okay,
who is that again?
He's a guy that looks a lot like a figure called Dark Complected Man, who sits down with the Umbrella Man after the assassination.
Okay.
They are dressed similarly in that they both have like a little cap there and glasses, but they are two different people.
He makes it to Parkland Hospital from Dealey Plaza.
Yeah, he was in the motorcade as a photographer. He's also at Love Field.
Okay.
So,
when he's in Love Field, he has kind of a tag on that hat.
Yes. See the guy with like a 3x5 card in his hat?
That's it.
Right there, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There are other photographs, but those are the two that I could find right away.
And we don't have copies of the photos he took. Is that what the...
No. I'm sure you do. I think he's a photographer with either the... The photograph of him at Parkland is either an Associated Press or a UPI photo. I don't recall this guy's name offhand. I would have to look it up, but I think he's known. He's a real photographer.
See, it looks like he took pictures of the limo inside.
That's not the limo right
there.
Look at that.
Okay.
That's the Johnson limo.
Johnson. Okay.
Yeah, we can tell by the lighter color of the door there.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, that helps clear, you know, one question up that we had of, you know, could it possibly be the same guy, and was he anyplace else around Dallas? Obviously, you know, he's standing there, and then he's also out at Love Field. Thank you, Joe, for bringing that out. And
the main thing is we know now that it's not Orlando Bosch.
Right.
Right.
Who Dark Complected Man is, I don't know. He's a completely different person from this photographer. That's all I'm saying is the photographer and Dark Complected Man are two different people.
Right.
I just put that photo in the chat, or I'm trying to. Okay. And the other one, boom.
Yeah, while Joe's working on that, I noticed that, you know, there's a lot of times where I have, I mean, I've got close to 500 books now on the shelves, a few bookshelves, actually. And I notice, you know, there's books that I read when I first got into this back in 1989. And there's books that, you know, I've gotten just last week. But there's times where we need to go back to the books that we think we know. You know, our minds go with age, and we need to go back sometimes and look at the books, maybe reread them, or at least go in and see if there's, you know, things that pop out now that, you know, didn't pop out 30, 35, 40, 50 years ago. So it's always good to revisit the, original research, whether it be books, documents, videos, photographs. And, you know, with time, your mind will make up a different take on it sometimes.
That's why I went back and read the Warren Report, because I haven't looked at it in like 40-some years. And rereading it is just, it's after reading all the research, it's very strange the way it's written.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I almost, I'm going to throw this out there anyway. It kind of reminds me of, you know, the fact of how you look at, you know, how you look at how it was written. If you go back and reread the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, look at the sentence structure, how things are, you know, especially run-ons or how things are talked about, you know, back, you know, you don't have to go that far back, but I did. And look at the Warren Report, or look at some of the books from the first generation researchers. You know, times are different, formats change, and structures change. And sometimes you get into some things that have no structure. So reading those Warren Commission, structure of, you know, the founding documents of the United States, it definitely makes you look at, you know, how things are done now compared to what they were done in the past. Well, does anybody else want to throw something in before we close? Because we're kind of at that point, guys. I think we discussed a lot of great information. We've got a few new studies, a few new revelations, especially in the photograph from J. Gary Shaw. We've got the photograph here, the discussion earlier from Larry, and Joe gave us a little bit better pictorial of that photograph. You know, that's what we do this for. You know, we like to be able to get together, you know, once a year or twice a year, whether it's a spring or a fall conference. But why we do the journey meetings and the spotlight series is to bring the researchers together on this kind of platform on a monthly basis or a regular basis. And that way you can ask questions, you can talk with each other, and, you know, we get a chance to have that camaraderie and discussions that we used to only be able to do, you know, in Dallas. So I'm glad we've got the technology, and I know how the hell to use it. Unfortunately, we have some shit that happened earlier, but, you know, we take that with a grain of salt, and I do my editing later. You know, you fix it in post. But, yeah, I want to thank everybody that, you know, is continuing to show up to our meetings, taking part in what we do. And it's not just me, Brian, and Casey. It's all of us working together to make what we have, you know, these meetings and or shows, whatever you want to call them, wouldn't happen unless we had you guys in the audience. You know, we're one big group. Sometimes we kind of, you know, act like family, where we may argue or we may, you know, have issues with one another. But the point is, we get a chance to talk and share ideas. And that's what we're doing here, is sharing the ideas, sharing the research, and what somebody may be working on. They're stumped. They want to know, like Gary, you know, and Brian put out the book. Help us find these people. Tell us who they are. Luckily, you know, Gary's nephew definitely went up points in my book, And I hope that, you know, he continues doing his research, and maybe he can, you know, maybe he can name a few more of the people. Maybe we can as well. That's what we do this for. So, again, make sure that you sign up for our events. Check out YouTube. If you like what we're doing, hit that like and subscribe button so you know when new videos come out. You can always ask questions.
And if you haven't given us the name of your representative, please do so.
Yes, do that. And like I say, me and Larry will be working on the video this week. It's not going to be a long, drawn-out video, probably 15, 20 minutes, and we'll get it up on the website. So that way you'll know how to do records requests and also get the form from Larry to send in and get the information that that is needed. So if that's where we're at, I'm going to go ahead and call this one today, and we will see everybody back on March the 6th, and hopefully with the new security measures in effect.
Hold on just a second. Hold on just a second, Dave.
Go ahead, Joe.
Got one more. Oh, if I can get it in. Hold on. Oh, cooperate. Well, I got one to you in the chat. I converted it to a JPEG. Trying to get the other one in.
And you said, David, you said we'll see you on March 6th, but I don't think you meant that.
No, I'm sorry. I meant April 6th. April 6th, and that's going to be the next journey meeting. April 12th and 13th is going to be our student symposium conference on the college campus in Overland Park, Kansas. So, again, you'll be able to find the journey meeting information on the events tab, and the JCCC student symposium will be on that tab on the website. It's the new tab on there for those that have been on the website consistently.
David's education is teaching him how to go back in time.
I gotta say this, my education has definitely
lost track of time.
Well, I lose more time trying to, you know, get shit done that I used to have more time on my hands now with all the stuff, but hey, I made president's list last I didn't make the dean's list, I made the president's list, which I guess is better last semester. I'm on the same deal to get another 4.0 GPA this semester. And, yeah,
well done.
I'm trying to knock it out. So,
speaking of time, I think clocks move forward tonight.
Yes, they do.
Do not forget, if you're in a state, I think there's two states that don't observe it, but everybody else does. So,
Arizona and
Indiana, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and Indiana is like, I think 3/4 of it does and 1/4 doesn't or something, or I don't know.
It would be nice to, you know, finally get on one. It messes up my internal clock because at least the next week I'm either going to be late or I'm going to be getting up too damn early. So that's the way it is every time the clocks change. But don't forget to set the clocks ahead.
Isn't Indiana the state where it actually has two time zones in it?
That is correct. I think. This has been debated for decades, but we are now on daylight savings time, but the north and southwest corners are in central time. The rest of the state's on eastern time.
I mean, how does that work?
Don't ask me.
Well, look at this way here. We're all Michael J. Fox, and we're, you know, it's bad enough when you're flying or driving in different time zones. When you're in the same state and there's more than one time zone, it gets trippy, so...
One of the motivating factors is to be consistent with time in Chicago. So I think that's why some Indiana regions want to be closer to Chicago's time.
Yeah, that's true for that corner, but we can't figure out why the Evansville area wants to be on Central.
Yeah. I used to work in Evansville, and I never understood that.
Wow. You must have to have at least kind of conversation. Rick,
sorry. Okay, I got them both in.
Yep, they're in the chat log, Joe. Definitely, I'm going to give you guys a couple minutes before we close. That way, if you want to go to the chat log and download anything that's been put in there, you know, I'll give you 5 minutes so that way you can do it and download what's in the chat log. While you guys are working on that, I will I'll throw this out. I want to thank the supporters that one, the supporters that are in this room that's taking part in the journey meetings, and for those of you that come to our events, whether it's on Zoom, whether it's in person, a big shout out and thanks to the individuals that have donated through PayPal on our website. You guys keep the bills paid so we can continue doing what we're doing. And I want to thank you guys again for that.
Any estimate on, I don't mean to draw you out here, but any estimate on the recordings from the November conference?
Yes. Oh, hell yes. Okay. I am on spring break, so I'm on track to get I'm on track to get the Memphis recordings done and also the Dallas recordings done. I'm hoping and keep my fingers crossed. March 18th, which is a Monday, it's in 9 days. I'm hopefully going to have everything available. Of course, it'll be available to purchase on flash drive at the conference, but the digital copies will be available on the website. You can, you know, make the payment and then download them digitally and save them to your own device for the Memphis Conference of 2023 and the Dallas Conference of 2023.
Sounds great. Thank you. I'm sorry that you have to give up your spring break from school to not have a spring break from school.
Well, no, believe me, I'm doing homework and catching up on stuff for school. I get to write a essay for Nixon versus U.S., the impeachment, and, you know, then resort that back to what's happened with Donald Trump. So that's my extra credit for getting a really – in my book – okay, I got a B on my exam in history class, so I wanted extra credit because I don't like Bs. I like As. You know, once you get them, you don't want to get anything less than that. So as soon as that happened, I said, can I do something for extra credit? And he goes, how about you want to write an essay? I said, sure, I'll write an essay. I don't have a problem with that. He goes, well, what do you want to do? And I want to do Watergate. And, of course, I wanted to kind of do it from the aspect of, you know, Mark Felt, the reporters, and then also the plumbers. But we're not talking about that in class. We are dealing right now with Supreme Court cases and Supreme Court justices and their opinions. So he decided to assign me a 750 to 1,000 word essay just on the opinion of U.S. v. Nixon, and then to turn around and then fold that back into is there a connection to what's been, you know, from that into what's going on with the impeachment of Trump. So, yeah, that's going to be my new thing to get done along with the videos. So I'll be working on two different laptops, but one will be doing videos while they're mixing, and the other one will be what I learned on Olye's website for the
David,
Supreme Court case.
David, I just sent you an email with the one-page PowerPoint on FOIA.
Oh, okay, perfect.
All right, so that'll at least let me just confirm you got it back in an email, okay?
Certainly, yeah. The Nixon Supreme Court acted with more alacrity in some cases, then the Trump case is crawling along.
There's some
Nixon case that got done in 4 days or something like that.
There's some interesting issues that were raised about the whole Watergate process, David. There's a guy, a lawyer that worked for the Nixon White House that has raised some interesting questions about the improprieties of Judge Sirica, the Watergate committee, and the prosecutor, that if it wasn't Nixon, there may have been some challenges to the way the investigation was conducted. But that would be...
Yeah, he's a pro-Nixon writer.
Yeah, but he's
very much pro-Nixon.
He's a lawyer. He's got some interesting observations that merit discussion.
It's too bad you're not doing the doing the paper on Watergate, because there's a tie-in. You know, I think I've mentioned that my mentor, and as well as Gary Shaw's, was Bud Fensterwald, the Committee to Investigate Assassinations. And as you probably know, Fensterwald represented James McCord, and it was the arrangement with McCord that basically got Sirica on board. And so there's a real interesting chain there. I'm not drawing any correlation to JFK because that's another three-hour, meeting. But I had some not direct but indirect, connections with that back in the day with Fensterwald when he was representing McCord. So
I just read something interesting where Carl Bernstein apparently was part of Nixon's staff in the White House at one point.
I had heard that.
And as it relates to how the story was formulated, was basically him from the inside. I have to remember where I read it or I saw it. I have to remember where, but it was really interesting because it changed the whole deep throat issue. That deep throat wasn't really deep throat. It was really Bernstein bringing the information into the picture and then to the Washington Post.
Well, it's always been a case that's fascinated me, but unfortunately I've always spent more time on JFK than I have Watergate. The only claim to fame I have is I got a chance to meet G. Gordon Liddy on a studio set. I delivered a truck to a TV show that he was being the bad guy on. It was called 18 Wheels of Justice, and I got a chance to drive one of the trucks to the site for them to use in the show. And as soon as I saw him come out of the trailer, I knew exactly who he was. And the funny part is, I stood there and I talked to him, not really about Watergate, but about, the show and some of the stuff that he was doing post being released from prison. And the one question he has, I'm surprised you didn't ask me about Watergate. And I said, I'm kind of on a time crunch and I got to get another load delivered. But, I get down the road to the truck stop and I realize I never asked the guy for his autograph, but I know I at least got a chance to meet him. So.
Well, getting back to Bob Saltzman's comment, it was the letter to Judge Sirica from McCord, of course, that really busted things open big time.
Yeah, I mean, that was the touch point.
Yeah.
I know it's just a personal anecdote, but I talked to Fensterwald three, four, five times a week, and I was working on a huge project for him to create a database of JFK material, which I did. So I called him, interestingly, on a Sunday at his home, and his wife answered and said that Bud was in the office. And I'm thinking, what Washington lawyer actually works in the office on a Sunday? But she said, if I called, he instructed me to call him in the office. And so I did, and he was just setting me up, and I didn't realize for what until later. But he said, Bob, I just wanted to talk with you just briefly. I have a client in my office. I can't divulge who he is or what it's about, but hopefully in a month or two, you'll remember this date and time that is a touch point in history, because Fensterwald had a very strong feeling that McCord's story and his arrangement with Sirica to become sort of he was outing the other four guys, in effect, for some criminal consideration. I don't remember the details. And so that whole arrangement was orchestrated by Fensterwald. And I always thought that was fascinating, because Fensterwald, is associated with James Earl Ray and so forth. So he's a pretty eclectic guy, notwithstanding the fact that over the years, people have accused him of just being another plant for the CIA. But he was a friend of mine, and I've always stood by him.
All right. Well, thank you, Bob. Well, I'm going to go ahead and bring this meeting to a close today. Again, this has been Project JFK CSI Dallas Presents The Journey, the March 9th, 2024 meeting. I'm your host, David Knight, with Project JFK. Thank you for attending, and thank you for watching and following us. Thanks, everybody, for, partaking on your Saturday. I'm sure there's things to do, but I'm glad you shared part of your day with us. And until then, we will see you next month. Have a good one, guys.